You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Strobe Talbot, and along with my colleagues here at the Brookings Institution, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. It's a special honor, obviously, to have Leader Pelosi with us. You, Nancy, have been a friend to this institution for a long time. You found your way down from the Hill to help contribute to events here in the Falk Auditorium, and it's terrific you could be here with us this morning. We have got a full program ahead of us with a lot of vitally important ground that we need to cover. But first, I want to make sure that everybody here appreciates the role that Glenn Hutchins has played as a leader of this institution and as a valued friend and counselor to those of us who are lucky enough to work here under his leadership. Glenn is not just a trustee and vice chair of our board. He is a thinker and doer in the realm of public policy. The center that bears his name, which we're launching today, is a case in point. The idea of an institutionalized, concentrated, disciplined, long-term, high-impact effort dedicated to fiscal and monetary policy has been germinating for a number of years in Glenn's fertile mind and in brainstorming sessions that he has held with our scholars. Now that idea has become a reality, which, by the way, is exactly what we at Brookings aspire to for ideas that are generated on this small campus on Think Tank Row. The seriousness of this new venture, the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy, is reflected in the distinction of the panel of experts, many of whom are arrayed here in the front rows, that we will be hearing from shortly. And, of course, we will be joined during the course of the proceedings by Ben Bernanke. Chairman Bernanke has been at the helm of the Fed for 8 years, though I suspect it seems like a lot longer to him. His extraordinary service to the nation at a time of extraordinary difficulty comes to an end just as the Fed reaches its centenary, which means it's 2 years older than the Brookings Institution. As these two institutions head into their second centuries, one thing is clear: the importance of designing and implementing measures that promote sustainable, widely shared prosperity, and that has never been more important as a goal and a challenge for our country. Monetary and fiscal policies are, of course, the purview of different parts of the federal government, but they have in common two goals: easing our immediate economic woes, particularly the persistence of high unemployment, while at the same time ensuring that decisions that we make today on spending, taxes, interest rates, and financial regulation lay the foundations for a better life for our children and grandchildren. That means fiscal and monetary policies need to be consistent and compatible if we are to accelerate our recovery from the recent crisis and ensure a healthy economic future. This is a classic challenge to the Brookings mission, which is contributing to the improvement of our system of governance. It's also an opportunity to apply the Brookings method, which is to convene the best experts, pose the right questions, marshal the relevant facts and make sure that they're facts, generate innovative, pragmatic, actionable ideas, debate their merits in a civil, constructive, nonpartisan fashion, engage the public, the private sector, and the policy community, and then advocate for sound policy. That's how the Hutchins Center will proceed under the leadership of its inaugural director, David Wessel, here in the front row as well, who is already working with the scholars of our economic studies program led by Ted Gehr, who's appropriately sitting next to David. It was with this agenda, with these values, and with this quality of leadership in mind that the center was conceived by its founder, from whom we will now hear. Glenn, the podium is yours, and so is our gratitude to you and to Debbie and to the Hutchins Family Foundation.
Strobe, thank you for those kind words. As the saying goes, my father would have enjoyed them and my mother would have believed them. Today, as you know, we're launching a new center on fiscal and monetary policy here at Brookings. And I'm very pleased and more than a little flattered that so many of you have joined us here today. Thank you. I'm also flattered that such a distinguished group of presenters will grace this stage today. Thank you, everybody, for making the effort. And I'm especially gratified that such important intellectual content has been generated for this event. That's emblematic of what we're trying to do. Today, I think today is a microcosm of what the Hutchins Center will do in the coming years and reflects why we situated it at Brookings. Let me explain. First, this event, like the center, was conceived and produced by my partners in this undertaking, Ted Gehr. There's a joke in there about Ted and David's glorious adventure somewhere, but we'll leave that for a later time. During the design phase of the center, Ted and I had a dialogue stretching out over a couple years, trying to determine how we could make a unique and tangible contribution to economic policymaking. We concluded that there was a surprising gap among think tanks in the monetary policy area. We could identify no research institution that was the leader or even a sustaining meaningful contributor in the domain. Further, we observed that most monetary policy research is conducted inside central banks around the world. For quite appropriate reasons, they impose material institutional constraints on what can be discussed and debated in public. We quickly understood that Brookings could fill this vacuum. But after thinking about that for a minute, we recognize that Brookings is also uniquely positioned to engage in the fiscal policy debate. We have experts in every major line item of the government budget, entitlements, defense, and the like, as well as a tax policy center, which is without peer in Washington. Being able to pool those resources, plus perhaps adding some capability, we're debating that to score legislation, struck us as uniquely available here at Brookings. We concluded that having an authoritative, I'm going to come back to some of these points in just a minute, nonpartisan and independent voice in the fiscal debate was a real opportunity and our calling. And once we started to think on this track, it became plain as day to us that the interaction between fiscal and monetary policy is powerful, as we all know and have experienced in recent years. And with the resources we have assembled here, understanding that interaction is the logical and third vital role that we can play. And then we struck the mother lode. After Ted and I had charted a rough course for the center, we began to test our hypothesis with subject matter experts, including many of you here today. One of the first people I approached was the widely recognized leader in the world of economics commentary, the legendary David Wessel. I was pleased that David thought it was a good idea, but I was thrilled that he wanted to lead it. I felt like I had struck gold. By the way, as I was writing this today, I thought I might ask some of you economists here today finally to explain to me why gold is so valuable, but that's a different point. David, thank you for taking all this on. Well done. For the vote of confidence in me, in Ted, and in Brookings. We appreciate it and look forward to it. Today's program is both David's creation and an example of what David and the team can accomplish at the center in the future. Now a word about Brookings, which I think, and I've said several times from this podium, is a national treasure. Brookings has three core values: independence, quality, and impact, all of which you'll see on parade here today, and which make it the ideal home for what Ted, David, and I want to do. At Brookings, we are uncompromising in our zeal to protect and promote the independence of our scholars. This is because we are committed to producing only the very highest quality, most data-driven, most rigorous research humanly possible. And we fundamentally believe that can only be accomplished when our scholars are absolutely free to pursue their research to its logical conclusion without ideological or financial fear or favor. As some of you know, I served in a Democratic administration during a brief sabbatical for my career in business, not unlike Brookings scholars who go in and out of government. But as a capitalist, and people ask me if I'm a Democrat or Republican, I say I'm a capitalist. But as a capitalist and citizen, something I admire about Brookings is its commitment to being nonpartisan. Not bipartisan, but emphatically nonpartisan. David spent his career at the Wall Street Journal, which has never been mistaken as a proxy for the left, I think. Ted Gayer performed distinguished service in Republican administrations. They're joined here at Brookings by a team of accomplished Republicans, Democrats, independents, from Ron Haskins, who worked for Speaker Gingrich and President Bush, to Alice Rivlin, who served so well in President Clinton's administration. I've chosen Brookings in part because Strobe has made it a priority to recruit scholars from both sides of the aisle, as well as those with no political identification. His only criteria has been the quality of their work. I challenge anyone in this room to name another research institution in Washington where as many Republicans, Democrats, and independents work under the same roof, and where as many Republican and Democratic elected officials are pleased to come speak. Given the polarization in Washington, that's one of the many things we all have to learn from Brookings. By creating an atmosphere of intellectual freedom and by insisting on exacting standards of quality, Brookings creates the conditions for the best minds in economics and other disciplines to devise practical solutions to real-world problems. And that is how we can have impact, which, in the end, is what we're trying to do. One last thought. Work at Brookings over the years has been gratifying to me in large part, as Strobe alluded to in his remarks, because the scholars have embraced and engaged with me as their peer, which has been very gratifying for me. Professionally, I study markets and the economy from the practical perspective of how to allocate capital and build businesses. They bring a perspective deeply informed by scholarship and the policy process. Together, we have found strength and insight in marrying scholarship and practice in a manner that ensures the real-world relevance and impact of our work. This is a collaboration that we plan to put at the very heart of our undertaking here. As everybody in this room knows, the recovery from the Great Recession has been muted and uneven. There are real and growing concerns about rising inequality, secular stagnation, and perils associated with unwinding of unconventional monetary policies. The attendant need for insights and tools to ensure a future of shared prosperity for our country has never been greater, and that's what we intend to do. Thank you. Ted.
Thank you, Glenn, for those inspiring words, and thank you even more so for your leadership and your commitment to dispassionate, high-quality, nonpartisan analysis of fiscal and monetary policy, which will now be the hallmark of the Hutchins Center. We launched the Hutchins Center today with a terrific agenda, examining the lessons learned and challenges ahead for the Federal Reserve. We'll start by hearing from John Williams and Martin Feldstein on the Fed's policies of quantitative easing and forward guidance, then from Paul Tucker and Rajan Kohn on regulation, and then finally from Don Kohn, Christy Romer, and Ken Rogoff on central bank independence. So it's just a fabulous lineup. Moderating these discussions will be David Wessel. I equally think we share with Glenn that we struck gold in having David here. I'm thrilled to have him as our newest senior fellow in the Economic Studies program and as the founding director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. David joins Brookings after 30 years at the Wall Street Journal, where most recently he was the economics editor and wrote the weekly Capital column. He's also the best-selling author of In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War and the Great Panic, and of Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. So with that, David, I just want to say again, welcome to Brookings, and I'll turn it over to you and the first round of panelists. So thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you, Strobe, Ted, and Glenn for those kind words and for making this possible. But I want to particularly thank the panelists up here and those who will speak later. They put a lot of work into writing papers for this thing, and then we tell them, okay, can you talk about it in 10 minutes? So I want to make sure that everybody's aware that we do have copies of these both outside and on our website, because though we'll try to do them justice in the short time that we have, we won't succeed. So there's much more to do. Our first paper is about really the extraordinary period in monetary policy we've been through. It was inconceivable if we'd been sitting here 10 years ago that anybody would have thought that the Fed cut interest rates to zero in 2008, and now the discussion is, will it be zero in 2015 or will it be 2016? And I don't think there's anybody better suited to talk about these policies than John Williams, the president of the San Francisco Fed, who did some of the fundamental research that the Fed relied on when it discovered that we were going to be faced with a threat as bad as the Great Depression. So, John, will you start?
Great. Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here. It's a wonderful event, and I'm very honored to be part of this. So I was given the task to talk about monetary policy at the Federal Reserve, and specifically around the issue of the zero lower bound. Now, I will say that the zero lower bound, basically the constraint that you can't lower nominal interest rates much below zero, was an issue that economists, academic, Federal Reserve, and other central bank economists had studied quite extensively back in the 1990s and before the global financial crisis. One of the things that spurred that research was the experience of the lost decade in Japan, and obviously the experience during the Great Depression in the United States. So economists thought hard and studied what, how big of a threat is zero lower bound, how to analyze it, what are the implications for monetary policy, despite the fact that at the time interest rates were well above zero, and quite a few people thought that it was more of an academic concern rather than a real world problem. But that research, which identified a number of issues and came to a number of conclusions, in my paper I highlighted three of them. And the first one, which I thought was very important, was the fact that the zero lower bound is a very real practical concern. It's not just an abstract concern. It's not Japan being special or unique or that something from the Great Depression. That's really an issue that we should take very seriously. In a paper I did with Dave Reifschneider at the Board of Governors, for example, we said if you followed the Taylor rule with a 2% inflation objective, you would hit the zero lower bound about 5% of the time. Some other estimates were a little higher. Some others were lower. So this is obviously an issue that's a very real practical concern. One thing we also identified in that research is that most of the time, and others who worked on this, that most of the time episodes of the zero lower bound would be relatively mild, relatively short-lived. In our simulations that we looked at economies, you'd be at the zero lower bound typically for about 1 year. And the effects of the zero lower bound typically would be relatively mild, as I said. We did find that about once a century, 100-year flood situations, you could have much more severe recessions that where the zero lower bound would be a bigger issue. But the first conclusion from that research was, yes, it's a real issue, probably most of the time not a dramatic, life-changing, say, issue. The second part of the research program, conclusion from that period, was that conventional monetary policy can and should be modified away from, say, a Taylor rule, a standard way of thinking about the Fed's reaction function, to something that took into account the zero lower bound. And there were two really strong and I think very important conclusions from that research. One was, don't keep your powder dry. If you think you're in danger of a recession or deflation, cut interest rates quickly, aggressively, get as much monetary stimulus in as fast as possible. The second was this lower for longer, and that is even after the economy starts to recover and things start to improve somewhat, instead of kind of being a race to raise interest rates again in a normal way, keep interest rates low, and that commitment for longer than you normally would, continue to add stimulus, basically reduce the risks of deflation, add more stimulus to help the economy grow faster because of the zero lower bound constraining policy during the time when interest rates were zero. So there are these two strong conclusions. One is act aggressively going in, an act slowly coming out about raising interest rates. Now, the third conclusion from the research before the crisis was really around truly unconventional monetary policies, and that's a quantitative easing, or for some reason the Federal Reserve, we still hold to the name large-scale asset purchases, or LSAPs. So just think of having an internet, you know, a translator in your mind. When I say LSAPs, you think QE. So one of the things that was studied was, could we use asset purchase, expand the balance sheet, intervene in foreign exchange markets? So a lot of research on that. Again, very academic, analytical, about how that might help lower interest rates, improve financial conditions when the short-term interest rate is at zero. And there was a number of research papers on how that could be done and a useful complement to conventional policies. Well, obviously, over the last 7 or 8 years, we've gained enormous experience both with these policies and with the lessons from that research. And so the paper, my paper goes through and says, well, what have we learned relative to what we thought in 2006 from this research? What have we learned? Well, and what have we also observed out there? The first part of the paper that I analyze is this issue of, is the zero lower bound really a big problem? Now, looking at the world outside today where all the major central banks have had interest rates at zero for 5 years straight. I mean, it's clearly a much larger problem than we identified in that research. So what I'm interested in the paper is why? What did we miss? Why is it the case that we thought the zero lower bound was going to be a relatively modest constraint most of the time, and in fact it's shown to be globally a huge issue? And one of the lessons that I try to emphasize in the paper is that I think we were fooled by the post-war U.S. data, especially the Great Moderation, which was a relatively small sample of data, where we really didn't have large shocks. We had a financial system, probably due to the lasting effects of the reforms after the Great Depression, the financial reforms from the 1930s. We had a financial system that was pretty strong. We had an economy that was behaving itself extraordinarily well. And when you analyze what are the tail risks in an economy where nothing bad happens, somewhat surprisingly, come to the conclusion that nothing bad ever can happen. And so one of the lessons of this, and Ken Rogoff's here, written quite a lot about this with Carmen Reinhardt, is you need to study history. You can't just think that what happened in the 1930s or what happened in other countries is irrelevant for the United States. Obviously, there's an issue of how do you weigh the evidence from the 100 years ago and from other countries, and that's a hard issue. But one of the things I show in the paper, which I thought was illuminating, was that if you looked at the data from the post-war period, the probability that real GDP per capita would fall as much as it did in 2008 was basically it would happen once every 400 years if you just took the data from post-World War II. By the way, real GDP per capita never fell more than 3% in the last 50 years before the Great Recession. In 2008, it fell by 3.7%. If you look at the broad historical experience, if you look at the 140 years of data from 17 advanced economies, you actually come to a very different conclusion. Real GDP per capita fell by more than 3.7% in a given year, more than 5% of the time. So it's about once every 20 years you would expect to see a major recession like we saw in 2008. So I think that, again, the lesson here is you can't just be looking at 25 years of the Great Moderation or even 50 years of the post-war period and drawing conclusions. So that was one of the conclusions I came from this. A lot of our macroeconomic research, a lot of the DSGE models, if I can use the jargon, that we use really don't help us think about tail risks or things such as what we've experienced in the last 7 years, and we really need to rethink that seriously. The other two parts of the paper is I look at forward guidance and quantitative easing. And as I mentioned in the opening remarks, one of the lessons from the research is that if you cut aggressively and you keep lower for longer, you can actually offset a lot of the effects of the zero lower bound. And in practice, we did see central banks across the globe cut aggressively. I mean, I think I list off maybe 10 countries that cut interest rates very aggressively, 2008, 2009. What we saw a lot more, much more challenging, was in doing this lower for longer and using somehow convincing financial markets that we're going to keep interest rates lower for longer. And in the U.S., for example, I talk about this in the paper, up until the August 2011 FOMC decision to put out this date that we're going to keep interest rates at zero to mid-2013, until that date, market expectations really were that the Fed was just ready and raring to go to raise interest rates within, say, three quarters or four quarters. And really the forward guidance that we finally instituted at that point and have expanded upon since then fundamentally shifted expectations about monetary policy, moved out expectations of when we're going to raise rates by at least a year, and since then has fundamentally shifted how markets perceive what the Fed's reaction function is. Since August of 2011, interest rate behaviors has been much more consistent with, I think, what our expectations are. You're not seeing the market expecting us to raise interest rates in the next year or so, and you can see this in terms of how the markets respond to news. You can see this in terms of surveys and market prices. So what we did find is it took quite a while for the Fed to go to explicit forward guidance. When we did, it did seem to have a major effect on changing expectations, major improvement in adding easing to financial conditions and helping the economy improve economic conditions. Finally, on QE, that was one of the most interesting issues because we really had very little knowledge of what the effects of QE would be on financial conditions of the economy when we went into this. There were a few papers going back to the 60s, theories about this, but this was really, in a way, flying blind. We had some analysis based on some specific circumstances. Since then, I think I list off maybe two dozen papers that have been written based on what's happened in the U.S., the U.K., and other countries. We've learned an enormous amount of how asset purchases affect the economy, but my point in the paper is we still don't understand a lot of it. Clearly, the evidence is when the Fed and other central banks do asset purchase programs, it affects long-term yields. It lowers interest rates. $600 billion on the U.S. for the U.S. Fed balance sheet seems to lower long-term treasuries by about 15 to 25 basis points, which is a lot for monetary policy. That said, there's a lot of uncertainty about how it works. Is it really a signaling of future policy actions? Is it really through some kind of imperfections in the financial markets that allows the Fed to buy assets and therefore affect the price? We also have a lot of uncertainty about the size of these effects, and we just have to recognize that. Finally, again, macroeconomists have ignored this whole aspect of imperfect financial markets and these aspects of imperfect information in a lot of our models. So our macro models we rely on to understand what are the effects of policies, what are the appropriate calibration of our policies, really have very little to tell us right now about quantitative easing policies. And a number of economists over the last few years, and clearly if you're a PhD student, this is a great topic to work on, have been working on developing models that allow us to think about QE and estimate its effects and think about policy with that. But that's still in its infancy, and we are having to use the models that we have now. But I just want to emphasize the one thing is it's clearly it works, but it's a very blunt tool and a lot of uncertainty around that. Now, to close, do I have one more minute? So to close, I think we came into this crisis or into the global financial crisis with having studied these issues about what should monetary policy do at the zero lower bound. I think we actually learned a lot from that about what's a good policy approach, what are the unconventional tools we could try to use. We've learned a lot about how effective they are, and they've proven to be effective. We've also learned a lot about some of the challenges with using them. Forward guidance is great in textbooks. Michael Woodford is always telling us exactly how we could do it. If we did forward guidance exactly like in his book, we would be golden. But in practice, explaining to the public and markets what monetary policy may or may not do in the next few years is very complicated and often prone to misinterpretation. Quantitative easing similarly has a lot of issues, not only about the uncertainty of its effects, but also just the concerns about unintended consequences. So that leaves us with some pretty big, important, open issues I think we need to think about for the next several years, many years. One is, importantly, is that 2% inflation buffer that pretty much every major central bank decided on to give you a little bit of cushion in a deep recession, is that really sufficient or appropriate or properly calibrated given the lessons we've learned about the zero lower bound and the severity of the recent recession. At the same time, I think we understand that we have to understand financial markets much better in our models and think seriously about how the financial market reforms will change things. And finally, I think the most interesting issue for monetary economics is was this whole inflation targeting regime that we've all agreed on, which has a lot of very positive benefits, really not as well suited for the zero lower bound condition as some alternatives, such as nominal GDP targeting or price level targeting. Now, I'm not taking a stand on any of those issues. I will tell you that changing the inflation target is the electric third rail of monetary economics, so I'm just laying them out as issues that I think we should seriously think about, and I think we need a lot of research and a lot of work on these over the next few years.
Thank you. We'll poll the audience. It answers each of those questions. So when we thought about who could reasonably comment on John's paper, Marty Feldstein immediately came to mind because he has been one of the few economists that's walked so seamlessly between policy and academic circles and is respected in both and has some views on whether the Fed did exactly the right thing. Take it away, Marty.
Thank you very much, David. Well, as you've heard, John has given us a very rich paper, which is worth careful reading, and I'm very impressed in how well he was able to summarize it in the 10 minutes that David gave him. I didn't get 10 minutes, though, to comment on it, and I realized that trying to comment in 7 minutes, which was David's assignment to me, I better write it down or I'd go on much too long. So let me read what I wrote after I read John's very insightful paper, which deals with the proper conduct of monetary policy under the protracted adverse conditions of the kind that we have experienced since 2006. Although we might hope that such conditions won't happen again, John presents persuasive historic evidence that such declines in aggregate demand are indeed likely to recur. So it's important that we learn from recent experience and consider alternative policies. The 2007 downturn was not only deeper and longer than the usual recession, but also differed in its origin and structure. It was not caused by temporarily high real interest rates and therefore couldn't be reversed by the Fed's usual rate reduction. Even at a near zero federal funds rate, the recession persisted. The downturn was caused by mispricing the risks of a wide range of assets. Individuals bought overpriced homes, and banks gave high loan-to-value mortgages to individuals who were unable to repay them. House prices began to collapse in the summer of 2006, causing a massive fall in household wealth and in residential construction. Banks and other investors bought overpriced tranches of securitized subprime mortgages that then collapsed in value, signaling the general overpricing of risky securities. In many cases, banks and other financial institutions couldn't even determine the value of their portfolio assets because of the lack of willing buyers and sellers. Banks, therefore, couldn't know the value of their own capital and couldn't judge the solvency of potential counterparties. The financial markets became dysfunctional and credit dried up. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury together acted very boldly to revive financial markets with a combination of asset purchases and guarantees that went far beyond monetary policy. Although these actions succeeded in reversing the financial collapse, they didn't reverse the economic downturn. The Federal Reserve also cut the Fed funds rate to near zero in late 2008. Too late, I think, to satisfy John's suggestion, and I quote, to act aggressively in cutting rates when a sharp decline in output threatens. That would have implied cutting rates in 2006 when house prices began to collapse. But the Fed funds rate was still nearly 5% in the fall of 2007. In analyzing the challenges in 2007 and 2008, it's important to go beyond simulations using the fat tails implied by historic data. I think traditional macroeconometric models cannot begin to capture the problems in 2007 because they lack well-specified financial sectors, let alone the tranche securitization of mortgages and the widespread presence of off-balance sheet special investment vehicles. Moreover, financial crises may not share the same features. Now, although this meeting is about monetary policy, I think it's wrong to ignore the role of fiscal policy at the zero lower bound. Conventional wisdom before 2007 was that cyclical fluctuations should be managed by monetary policy alone because countercyclical fiscal policy is generally too slow to react within the typical recession downturn. But in 2007, several of us concluded that current conditions implied that a fiscal stimulus was needed. Unfortunately, the Bush tax cut of 2008 was totally ineffective, a small one-time rebate that households almost entirely saved. The Obama stimulus plan of 2009 probably dampened the downturn, but was too small and not concentrated enough on increasing government spending. So with an inadequate fiscal policy, the Fed was the only hope for stimulating the economy. With the Fed funds rate at the ZLB, the Fed shifted to unconventional monetary policy of future guidance of the short rate and large-scale asset purchases, the LSAPs, of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. John provides a very useful review of the evolution of the short rate guidance. And he concludes from it, and I quote, "Explicit forward guidance can effectively anchor interest rate expectations out 2 years." But I ask myself, why is a 2-year anchoring economically significant? The usefulness of forward guidance would be persuasive if it reduced the longer term rates that are relevant for mortgages and equity prices. John reminds us that the standard textbook theory implies that LSAPs cannot affect asset prices and interest rates. We now know that that theory is wrong. The Fed's massive purchases of Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities drove the yield on 10-year Treasuries to just 1.7% in May of 2013. The announced plan to end the purchase program was enough to drive that rate back to 3%. John quotes research showing that the $600 billion bond purchase in QE2 lowered the unemployment rate by 0.25%. But he's candid in concluding, as he said in his remarks, and I quote from the paper, "a great deal of uncertainty about the magnitude of these effects and their impact on the overall economy." But missing in all of this analysis is a balancing of the potential output gains of LSAPs against the risks generated by sustaining abnormally low long-term interest rates. Those risks include, one, potential price bubbles in equities, land, and other assets. Two, portfolio risks as investors reach for yield with junk bonds, emerging market debt, uncovered options, and the like. Three, creditor risks as lenders make loans to less qualified borrowers, covenant-light loans and bonds, long-term mortgages at insufficient interest rates, and so on. And four, long-term inflation risk as commercial banks acquire a large portfolio of low-yielding assets at the Federal Reserve that could be converted to commercial loans. In his conclusion, in the paper and in his remarks, John asks whether LSAPs should be a standard tool when short rates are at the zero lower bound. I think it is, at best, too soon to tell. We will know more when we see the outcomes of the risks that the LSAPs created. And if the economy now expands at a healthy pace, which I think we've got a good shot at, we won't know what those risk outcomes would have been in a weaker economy. What is clear to me is that a balanced fiscal policy should be part of the response when the economy is stuck with excess capacity at the zero lower bound. Finally, John also asked whether it would be better to target nominal GDP or the price level or an inflation rate higher than 2%. I think any of those would be a mistake. Although inflation is not a problem now, the time will come when the Fed will want to limit or reverse inflationary pressures. Experience and theory both teach us that it is easier to do that if the public understands that the Federal Reserve is committed to a consistent policy of low inflation. Flirting now with other, more ambiguous goals can only weaken future public support when the Fed needs it most. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. John, let me ask you to respond to two of the several interesting points that Marty made. When you describe the history of monetary policy in this crisis, you didn't mention fiscal policy. But we know that fiscal policy was a big player and, to quote Ben Bernanke, was counterproductive. So when we get to this stage, an episode like this, what is the right thing for the Monetary Policy Authority to do? Do you compensate for lousy fiscal policy, do more? Or do you say to the fiscal authorities, the Congress and the President, look, we're doing this, and publicly indict them for not doing the right thing? How do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I don't think fiscal policy was lousy. We actually had pretty sizable fiscal stimulus. I would agree with Marty, the more would be better.
Thinking more recently.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing, okay, but I would say that in the depths of the recession, 2008, 2009, 2010, there was quite a bit of extraordinary fiscal stimulus, which I think was very helpful. Now, the fact that it's turned the other way, obviously, is more of a negative. So the way I think about this, obviously, is from the point of view of monetary policy, you have to take fiscal policy realities as given and the political realities around that. So we have to take essentially, it's given that fiscal policy is doing what it is, and we have to have monetary policy as best calibrated as we can to achieve our mandated goals from Congress, maximum employment and stable prices. That said, I agree completely that we should, the leadership of the Federal Reserve can and should speak clearly and forcefully about the effects of, or the beneficial effects of countercyclical fiscal policy, especially at the zero lower bound. I do think that that's a message that I think most economists would agree on, and I think is obviously logically makes a lot of sense. That said, I think that there is the reality that, you know, Washington does what it does, and we have to try our best given the hand we're dealt.
And what about the risk that what you're doing now is just sowing the seeds of the next bout of financial instability?
In terms of these issues of greater risks.
How much do you worry that what you're doing now, because we're clearly missing both the inflation and the unemployment target that you've set, or the mandate, is risks creating financial instability that'll give Janet Yellen a lot of headaches in her term?
Well, you know, we take this very seriously. Obviously, you know, we've all learned the lessons of the past decade or so. We follow very carefully what's happening in financial markets, both in the banking part of the financial system, but most importantly, and Paul's going to talk about this some, this is a capital markets-based economy. So it's not just the banks. You have to think about the shadow banking system and the rest of the system. So we're clearly studying this. We clearly have really increased our monitoring and our analysis around this. you know, my argument would be the first line of defense regarding issues of growing financial risks or is really around micro and macro prudential policies, developing both having the right policies and implementing them. You know, I think the stress test, I'm going off onto the next subject a little bit, but I think we've made incredibly important strides in terms of financial stability, in terms of the stress test, in terms of our implementation of Dodd-Frank. So to my mind, we are on the job on that. We are studying that carefully. And we are balancing the costs and benefits around our QE policies. And, you know, I view very strongly that the macroeconomic benefits far outweigh some of these issues right now. Risk aversion today in the markets generally, you can find specific examples of, you know, of farmland prices or leveraged loan prices, but, you know, it, broadly defined, our financial system is still in a risk-averse mode, not a risk-loving mode. So I think that these concerns today and are still perhaps not as prevalent as some people think.
I'm going to offer Paul Tucker a chance to ask a question before we turn to the audience.
A comment and a question.
Please.
First of all, I very much agree with Marty's conclusion that don't give up on inflation targeting. That battle was hard won, and it constantly needs to be reaffirmed. My question is, I think central bankers elsewhere in the world are puzzled by the Fed's flow approach to quantitative easing. Rather than deciding on a stock of money, base money or broad money, if you like, that you want to put out there, and then review after a while whether you've done enough, just as you would set an interest rate and leave it and then decide after a while whether you've done enough. Instead, you've had this policy of we'll trickle it out there on a flow basis. I think other central bankers have found that interesting.
I've never heard $85 billion a month called a trickle, but... So, you know, we've obviously been trying different approaches on that. You know, the QE, you know, QE1, QE2, in terms of QE2 is a concrete example of a $600 billion purchase over a certain specified period of time. It provides a lot of certainty in markets. Markets like that. It provides a lot of, bang for the buck in the sense that when you make the announcement, the market reaction occurs immediately. So there are positives to that. There's definitely clarity around it. The problem is that that's not how monetary policy should be conducted. Monetary policy should be conducted by adjusting your instruments as the economic conditions, economic outlook evolve. So one of the lessons I think we've learned from those earlier episodes was we were surprised that the economy did not do as well as we thought. We needed to introduce a new program, you know, QE2, then Operation Twist and Extending Twist. So by having this more open-ended policy, which, of course, markets come to conclusions or their own analysis about how big the policy eventually will be, by having it open-ended, it had the advantage that it automatically can be adjusted both in size, composition, and duration as economic conditions change. And I think that's what we laid out. This is a substantial improvement in the outlook for the labor market. The economy didn't do as well as we thought. We've been doing these purchases longer than people originally thought. I remember the question when we started this program that I was asked, would you do $600 billion on this? Well, now, obviously, because of the change in economic conditions and the outlook, we're obviously doing far more than that. And that's exactly what we should be doing, given what's happened with the economy. As with the taper, we're adjusting that based on changes in economic conditions, improvement. So I think it's a natural thing to do is to adjust your policy instrument as the economic outlook changes. That said, I do recognize that it creates quite a bit of uncertainty. When will the Fed stop its purchases? When will taper? We had the famous taper tantrum last year. And I think we do, it's something we've learned. We learned that when you have a $600 billion policy, you don't have the flexibility to adjust that as economic conditions change, and that's a weakness of that. We've also learned that there's a lot of communication challenges and I think confusion when you have it simply open-ended with a relatively vague condition for bringing it to an end. So I think this is something we need to think more about.
We have time for a couple questions. If you have one, raise your hand and wait for a mic. Tell us who you are. And remember that a question ends with a question mark because we are on a tight schedule. Greg, up there in the middle. Greg, stand up.
Greg Yip with The Economist. Question for both John and Marty. John, the real output effects of quantitative easing that you identified were based on models that link the decline in long-term interest rates to the output effects. But as you and Marty have both said, we have vastly misunderstood the linkage between the role that the financial system plays in terms of changing interest rate and what that actually does to the economy. You can make the case in the last 4 or 5 years that the that frictions in the financial markets have really blocked the transmission of monetary policy in the way it normally does. So doesn't that weaken the empirical link that you've drawn between the effect of quantitative easing and the impact on the real economy?
Yes. Absolutely. I agree. We obviously have seen, especially after the financial crisis, I think of this as if you think of the U.S. economy as a 8-cylinder auto engine, you know, several of the cylinders have, especially early on, were clogged. I think they're getting less clogged now. That said, there's no question that both are lowering through forward guidance interest rate expectations out of the next couple years and through quantitative easing over the 5 and 10 year horizon has lowered mortgage rates, lowered auto rates, lowered corporate borrowing rates. And what parts of the economy are we seeing the biggest improvement? You know, autos and durable goods, obviously the housing market finally is turning around and improving. So I agree with the point that the monetary transmission mechanism has been partially clogged over the last few years. At that same time, you know, the very aggressive policies have had an effect, have gotten traction, and I think are a really important part of the economy improving.
John Hilsenrath and Beck.
John Hilsenrath from the Wall Street Journal. John, a question for you. The Fed employed a low-for-longer approach after the tech bubble burst. Several years later, we had a housing bubble. I wanted to ask you, what is the risk that a low-for-longer, specifically a low-for-longer policy, could contribute to bubbles? Does it disturb you at all that it doesn't seem that the Woodford models upon which low for longer is based take much account for the creation of bubbles? And how should this factor into the Fed's thinking now as it employs a low for longer policy again?
Well, I agree with Marty on this point. There are models that we use do not take seriously that there's a financial system, a complex financial system out there that can have endogenous changes in leverage, in risk-taking. And I would also add to that, our models tend to assume highly rational agents who are have a full understanding of things, so bubbles never occur. So I do think in our thinking about these issues, we have to broaden our minds to more of a approach that allows for the fact that these things can happen, that asset markets can get away from fundamentals for significant periods of time, financial markets can get disrupted. My answer to your question is I don't think that the low interest rates were an important contributor to the housing bubble. I think fundamentally flawed aspects of our regulatory environment were the key part of that story about the housing bubble. I think that Dodd-Frank and Basel III and a lot of the other things we're doing are addressing those concerns in a very important way. That said, I do think that we have to have open minds about understanding how low interest rates for a long period of time do affect risk-taking, leverage, and asset prices, as Marty said.
As a woman here in the middle.
Hi, I'm Abby Joseph Cohen, and a very proud trustee of the Brookings Institution. Pleased to be here for the opening of the Hutchins Center. Marty Feldstein made a very interesting comment before, and that was all the Fed needed to do was mention taper, and financial markets adjusted. One of the things we saw was that the biggest adjustment wasn't in the United States. It was, in fact, in emerging markets, especially emerging market debt, which really raises the whole question of what is it that we don't know about the linkage, not just between our financial markets and monetary policy, but also markets around the world. And specifically, what do we think now about the interplay of central bank policy from different nations, and also, very importantly, the regulatory differences, particularly with regard to the supervision of financial institutions?
Oh, yes or no on that one?
I was going to say, let Marty take it.
We'll let Marty have it. You can answer, and Marty can answer, and then we'll move on.
Well, I do think that, you know, obviously we saw hot money flows going to emerging market countries during the last few years. We saw big swings in those flows around the when the discussion of the tapering happened. I think that for my perspective, the most important thing is that we're communicating very effectively across the globe with our central bank colleagues, and that communication includes understanding what our policies are and what our intentions are. I also think that, you know, as we've seen the last few years, these countries who have been affected, no question, affected in a major important way by these flows, need have adapted their policies and their approaches to better insulate them from some of those effects. That said, in the end of the day, we live in a modern global financial system, and this is, I think, just part of the world that we live in. In terms of monetary policy in the U.S. is obviously having effects outside the U.S., and we need to study those, we need to understand those, and we need to coordinate communicate effectively with our colleagues around the world.
You want to add to that, Marty?
The only thing I would add is I think the Fed doesn't take those effects on other countries into account.
And so
probably not.
They should. Can I add something? They should, to the extent that there is a risk that it will flow back into the United States.
Yes.
What you're describing is the cross-border, cross-currency currency carry trade. It's been ignored in the economics profession and in central banking for far too long. And it doesn't just flow one way. It can bounce back. The concerns in this capital about the worst of the euro area crisis demonstrated the linkages of the world don't just run from here to there. They can flow back as well.
So let's turn to the second part of our program, which is, can we use financial regulation to prevent a repeat of this crisis? And if so, how far along are we on that path? And to talk about that, we've invited Paul Tucker, who until recently was the deputy governor of the Bank of England, is now at Harvard, where he came to Boston because he says the weather was better than it is in the UK. take it away, Paul.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to be here. Well, as John said, while macroeconomic policy probably contributed to the conditions in which the crisis occurred, the ultimate cause of the depth of the crisis was a deeply flawed regulatory and supervisory regime, deeply flawed in design and deeply flawed in implementation on both sides of the Atlantic, and it would be hard not to do better. The paper that Brookings have published covers a whole load of technical things because it's a technical subject, but I want really to pick out one or two things that are more in the realm of political economy. And there's good news as well as, I think, some challenging news. The good news is something which, if I may say so, I think the Ben Bernanke's Federal Reserve System has a great deal to be proud of, which is stress testing. I think this can potentially revolutionize bank supervision over the coming quarter of a century. I think it will take some while to play out and mature, and I think it will be some while for its full effects to be seen. But it's revolutionary in two respects, or perhaps even three. First, and this is not trivial, it gets the macroeconomists and the supervisors within not only the Federal Reserve but other central banks to work together. This is a necessary condition for central banks to have the broad mandate which they are now returning to. Secondly, it makes regulators look at banks in a joined-up way rather than atomistically. If you like, this is part of the macroprudential label. But I think almost most importantly, I think it can transform the accountability of the Federal Reserve and other central banks and regulators around the world to legislatures and the public. Monetary policy is something where over the past 10, 20 years, it's become increasingly transparent, and what the public gets is what it can see on the tin, the laws, the regimes, the models, the policy deliberations. Bank supervision has been opaque, mysterious, of interest to the public only when it goes wrong. But when it goes wrong, suddenly it's rightly of enormous interest. By having an annual stress test, putting the degree of stress that is going to be applied to the institutions into the public domain, and the results of the stress test with named institutions in the public domain. That gives members of Congress, on behalf of the public, an ability to ask the Federal Reserve and the OCC and others questions about supervision that they have never been able to ask before. I think that is a massive step forward, and I think it's very important, for those of you that work on the Hill, I think it's very important that Congress delivers in asking those questions on the stress tests each year. The other feature of it that is tremendously important goes to the whole business of central bank lender of last resort policies and support operations. And that's been controversial in this country, especially over the past few years. And it's been controversial, crudely, because people think that the Federal Reserve may have lent to firms that were bust and may have lent to non-banks that were bust. And transparent stress testing, whether or not that's true or not, transparent stress testing makes this much less of a hazard in the future. Because if a firm that is in receipt of lender of last resort assistance is insolvent, that is going to be revealed and revealed publicly by the subsequent stress test. This is potentially a very significant disciplining device on the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the ECB, and one that I think has been underappreciated to date. Let me make three other points quickly. The biggest issue on the banking side is, can the too-big-to-fail problem be solved? And I believe it can be. I believe it's on the brink of being solved. It's now a question of will, whether policymakers can bring it over the line. Now, it would be a good thing if there could be an international treaty, but there will not be an international treaty. And therefore, for those people in this country especially, but elsewhere, who advocate that when a vast institution is bust, that it goes through the courts, they are ignoring the reality that courts can, in different countries, cannot cooperate ex ante because you don't even know which judge is going to be sitting in London or New York on the day that the case is brought to the court. So this is inevitably, whether one likes it or not, as a matter of political philosophy, it is inevitably a matter of interagency cooperation across border. And the solution, and I won't get technical about it, is essentially to push losses from subsidiaries up to holding companies, and for holding companies to issue sufficient bonded debt to the capital markets that when the equity is exhausted, the bonds can be converted under administrative discretion into equity and the firm recapitalized. And this can make this problem largely go away. There's more about that in the paper, and I don't doubt that Roger will pick it up. But let me come to things that concern me more. If too big to fail is the biggest problem confronting Western society in the financial reform arena, a close second is regulatory arbitrage. I believe that the banking reforms are coherent and reasonably well conceived, but no one should kid themselves that tomorrow's problems are going to be located in banks. They may be in banks, but they're as likely to have traveled elsewhere. Finance, more than any other part of a modern economy, is a shapeshifter. You think the problem is over there and you aim your instruments at it, and it instead will be over here. This is a tremendous challenge in terms of flexibility. There's another one that John alluded to. Can monetary policy stimulate risk-taking and bring about conditions of bubbles and of bursts and collapses? Yes. And as John rightly said, that requires the regulators to have a more dynamic approach to the regulation of institutions, raising capital requirements or liquidity requirements during the boom. But again, that requires flexibility. And here's the rub. What society is typically like, what legislature is typically like, is rule-based regulation, so that unelected agencies don't have untrammeled discretionary power. And that's a good principle. It is a hard principle to reconcile with effective regulation of the financial system and keeping it safe and sound. And this is almost not debated at all in this country, because such is the devotion to rules here. In the United Kingdom, it has been debated, and the solution in part is an expedited legislative procedure to enhance the tools of the regulators when needed. You need that debate, and the rest of the world needs you to have that debate. And my fourth issue is this, and in some respects I think this is the biggest of all, because the problems are never technical, or they shouldn't be technical. The problems are about building effective institutions, agencies in the state sector. Regulatory arbitrage means that a lot of the problems that threaten stability are as likely to come under the jurisdiction of securities regulators as they are under the jurisdiction of the bank regulators or the central bank. But the securities regulators, they do a great job. They do not have financial stability in their statutory objectives here or in many other parts of the world. And if you look at their congressional testimony, rarely are they asked any questions about the stability or the threats to stability that could come from the parts of the financial system that they are responsible for keeping safe and sound. Either their statutory objectives need to be broadened, altered, which is a much more important issue than the question that gets raised occasionally here of whether the SEC and the CFTC should be merged. Or alternatively, some other body, whether it be the FSOC or the Federal Reserve or some new agency, needs to be given a power of override so that they can ensure that all parts of the financial system are sufficiently resilient to weather the next bubble. And if that doesn't happen, then the next crisis will be sooner than otherwise.
Thank you. To respond, we invited Raj Cohen, Sullivan and Cromwell, who I think counts every bank in the United States at one time or another has sought his counsel. So we thought it was good enough for them. It's good enough for us, and we don't pay anywhere near your hourly rate, so we appreciate you.
Thank you, David, and for Brookings, it's truly a labor of love. To even begin to scratch the surface of Paul's thoughtful, comprehensive, and provocative paper, it would really take much more than my allotted 7 minutes, so I'm just going to focus on two fundamental points. First, it is undeniable that the risk of failure of a major bank must be sharply reduced from what it was in 2008 by reform of the regulatory system, and that the systemic consequences that could result from such a failure must be dealt with by a credible and effective resolution regime. But as Paul writes, and I'll quote, the banking package of reforms is coherent and well-conceived, seeking to address the deep-seated flaws in our banks and regulatory system, including the biggest of all, too big to fail. So in other words, although there is still much to do, we are generally on the right track. Calls for more radical reform of not just the regulatory system, but the basic structure of the banking system are both unnecessary and fraught with their own risk. As Paul later notes, narrow banking could not on its own make the world safe. Indeed, I would suggest that reducing bank geographic and business diversification, and to Paul's point this morning, pushing financial activities into the shadow banking sector could have exactly the opposite effect. Second and relatedly, Paul makes the crucial point, and I'll quote again, solving too big to fail matters hugely because improvements in bank regulation and supervision alone will not consign distress to the dustbin, unquote. There are two aspects of placing too big to fail into its own dustbin. The first is moral hazard, which is dealt with directly by Dodd-Frank in mandating that creditors as well as stockholders bear all losses in the event of a failure. The second is a resolution regime that can minimize the risk of serious systemic consequences. As Paul mentioned, essential to his approach for developing such a regime is a combination of long-term debt at the holding company level and internal debt at the operating subsidiary level, what is sometimes known as prepositioning. In the event of catastrophic losses, the banking organization's equity would absorb the losses, and the debt would become equity to provide a cushion for recapitalization. Let me discuss three issues quickly. The first is how much. At the holding company level, I agree with Paul's view that the amount should generally be around 10% of risk-weighted assets for more complex institutions, assuming an equivalent amount of equity. You can cite historical examples of institutions that have encountered even greater losses, but the long-term debt requirement should be calibrated to a reasonable worst case in today's regulatory environment rather than to the worst result ever. I believe, however, that if there is to be prepositioning, the amount of internal debt required at the operating subsidiary level should be based on a lower percentage of RWA, perhaps 5%. The principal reason is flexibility. In the event that an operating subsidiary experiences losses greater than its equity, as unlikely as that might be, the holding company would then have a reserve of recapitalization assets to fill the hole after utilizing the pre-positioned debt. In addition, I worry that a higher requirement will encourage ring fencing, which is antithetical to the type of resolution structure that Paul supports. The second issue relates to the conditions for pulling the debt into equity trigger. In my view, triggers should not be hair triggers, and the regulators need discretion, but it needs to be limited. I would recommend a typical insolvency test, inability to pay debts as they become due. If we have a specific capital depletion trigger, it should be at a level where any private sector recapitalization is improbable. I recommend this approach because once the trigger is pulled, the life of the banking institution is likely to be measured in days, if not hours. Funders and counterparties will flee, and once one host country pulls the trigger, it will be difficult for others to resist. And if a major bank is prematurely placed in a resolution proceeding, the world's financial system will be plunged into uncertainty. I accept the too late concern, but this should be allayed by the substantial debt shield that Paul proposes. Now, there is a special issue relating to host country discretion. Paul suggests that the host country must have a hand on the trigger because otherwise, he writes, host authorities would likely be worried that the home authorities might not, in fact, pull the trigger. I would suggest perhaps the option of adopting obligations for action at the parent level as opposed to placing too many hands on what is a truly nuclear trigger. And the third and last issue created by Paul's proposal is how will the resolution regime, and he mentioned this morning, be established and implemented on an international basis. As a general principle, the more binding the international arrangements are, the greater the certainty that the regime will be implemented as intended. This principle will, however, need to be applied in the context of political reality. It could be best effectuated, I believe, by binding treaties, but if that is not feasible, as Paul suggests, there should be a formal written document endorsed by the regulator, central banks, and ideally by the G20 heads of state or finance ministers. One other possible approach is a series of understandings among the key regulators. In my view, this is an inferior option, as the market may assume that it is not worth the paper it is not written on. Let me close with Paul's summation and endorse it. Solving the TBTF problem is definitely within reach. It is now a matter of will. And to note that Chairman Bernanke so vividly demonstrated that where there is a will and courage of conviction, there is a way. Thank you.
Thank you, Raj. Can I ask you a little bit broader question? The tone of Paul's paper is that we're pretty much on the way in renovating bank regulation. We have a little ways to go. And we have a long way to go in regulating the non-bank parts of the financial system. Do you think that there's a risk that this all sounds good, but we're basically, A, going too far and constraining credit, or B, making something so complicated that there's no chance it'll ever work?
I actually think the package of reforms today is a relative reasonable reform. What concerns me, and I wish someone, maybe it's Brookings, but OFR, would actually study everything that is being done as a on a holistic basis before you can determine your very critical question of whether there's going to be a constraint on credit. I do worry that the interaction of so many of these could produce a constraint, even though no one proposal or no one reform is doing so.
What do you think of that?
I mean, and I basically agree with that. Something that may not have been studied very much in this country is the Liikanen report about the restructuring of EU banks. Whatever one thinks about its conclusions on structure, the first two-thirds of the report is a pretty careful study of all the different regulatory measures in a joined-up way. I think the problem with the non-bank or the markets part of it is the lack of a conceptual framework. There's a chart towards the beginning of my paper. The banking policies, for good or ill, are clearly informed by a sense that the problems were excess leverage, excess opacity, excess interconnectedness, excess maturity mismatch, and too big to fail. And behind each of those things lies a body of analysis and economic research. There is no equivalent framework for thinking about markets policy. The most important point I think I make for policymakers in the paper is that they badly need a framework for markets policy, and that I think it has to be something to do with where trying to identify which markets are systemically relevant because the economy or the financial system depends so heavily on them, and then whether the liquidity of those markets is illusory or resilient. What we saw in the asset-backed securities market, and in particular the associated secured money market, was everyone behaved as though these asset-backed securities were information insensitive, completely safe. But actually they flipped to being highly information sensitive very quickly, almost as soon as something went wrong. That could have been foreseen, I believe, if policymakers and analysts and economists had had a framework for thinking about the resilience of markets as well as a framework for thinking about the resilience of firms. And I do think this is on the way. People like Bengt Holmstrom and Gary Gorton and others have been talking about precisely those things.
John, a question or comment?
I was struck by the discussion around convertible debt, and Paul's paper talked a lot about that, in addressing too big to fail. I guess the concern I always have is with these trigger points, and you talked about nuclear options and things like this, is, you know, once people start worrying that this trigger may occur, you get immediately, the financial markets don't wait around to find out. They're going to run, or potentially could run. And it just, whenever I hear a discussion about convertible debt, I immediately think...
This is a very Federal Reserve point of view.
Oh, wait a minute.
Is that a compliment?
Obviously, David, the
Federal Reserve thinks that all the problems are liquidity problems.
No, wait a minute, no.
And the liquidity problems are curable... If you can sort out the solvency of the institution.
Okay, but my question was...
Trying to make this interesting.
I'm trying to make it... Wait till you hear what I say, Paul. What's wrong with just having more equity? Anat Amati and her co-authors have, you know, basically been pleading for the last couple of years. Just hold more equity. Don't make it complicated. Don't make it too sophisticated. Just more equity.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, but it hasn't happened. And the Federal Reserve nor the Bank of England argued for more equity. So you can take what I'm describing as second best, if you like, but conditional on the policy on equity that we have, then what's to be done? And it's not quite convertible. I know you know this, but just for the audience and for those watching, this isn't convertible equity in the sense of a convertible bond. This is regular senior bonded debt, which, as Rog describes, could be flipped into being equity at the discretion of the authorities. And I think Rog raises a profoundly important point about what's the trigger. And you have a bankruptcy trigger. Mine is very similar. It would essentially be that the authorities should not have the power to do this unless the institution otherwise fulfilled the criteria for going into resolution or bankruptcy. So that's pretty converged between us, I think.
I would say that there is a big difference between equity and potentially convertible debt in terms of the cost of the funds to the bank and therefore ultimately to its customers. And so I've always been attracted to the idea of having this extra class of security, which is debt that can be converted to equity when there is a critical moment where more equity is needed, rather than having straight out higher equity ratios.
Because why?
Because of the relative costs of the
cheaper
different classes.
Cheaper to do the bonds.
Cheaper to do the bonds, which have a certain probability of turning into equity, but are not full-scale equity.
So question here. Why don't you stand up so they can, the mic can see. Wait for the, well, the clearinghouse. We didn't get to that part.
Hi, Paul Saltzman, president of the clearinghouse. I'd like to follow up on Paul's comments regarding stress testing and ask both for the macroeconomists and the more regulatory-oriented folks, is there a tension between the integrity associated with stress testing and at least some concerns that stress testing, at least as it's currently envisioned, is a little opaque? The modeling is opaque and not transparent, and the assumptions are somewhat subjective. How do you reconcile those tensions with the effectiveness of stress testing?
Well, I actually agree with everything Paul said about this. I think stress testing is the most important transformative change in our supervisory approach. Is it opaque? I think actually we've tried pretty hard to make it more transparent. Is it subject? You said subjective assumptions. Well, yes, they're subjective assumptions. I mean, you're going to do that. You're going to come up with scenarios that are, you know, based on some analysis and things. But, you know, this, it's awfully hard, at least today, to formally say this is the appropriate way exactly to model that. I do think that one of the very important cultural changes that we've seen at the Federal Reserve, and I'm assuming at other institutions, is economists and regulators and supervisors actually talk to each other and work together and think about these issues. And we're now in the Federal Reserve using our economists to do risk modeling and analysis that's used in the supervisory process. And the economists have learned, you know, the importance of the supervisory approach, too. So I think, yes, there's issues about the subjective and things. There's a lot of research going on in the Fed, which is quite intriguing, about how to properly actually frame the question of how to do stress testing and how to analyze this and think about that. So it's an area of a lot of research, but to my mind, you know, it's been a fundamental change and a positive change.
So the stress testing is a very good thing. On the other hand, when you think how complex large financial institutions are and you think what would happen in case of economic weakness or a replay of the events of 2007, very, very hard to have any confidence in the outcome of those stress tests. So it's important. It's got to get better over time, but it's a little frightening in terms of depending upon it. And then if you think about the application of this in the Eurozone, there are lots and lots of doubts about whether that's being done in a fair and honest and open way with respect to all of the countries.
I thought that the issue was that the banks want, tell us what we need to do, and we'll do those things.
That's right.
And the Fed is saying, we don't want to do that way because you'll just game the system like that. Paul said.
That's exactly
so
right.
Are the stress tests being done well, in your view?
I think in the United States, they are definitely being done well. If you can just imagine how much time boards of directors alone are spending on reviewing those stress tests. Yes, I think they are being done well. But I must say, to Marty's point, that it is very difficult for us to sit here and criticize the European stress tests as too weak, not sufficiently rigorous, and they are too opaque when the models the Fed is using are opaque. And if there's not a willingness to reveal the models beforehand and worry about gaming, there is a value, I think, in an ex post basis, so there can at least be legitimacy of the models that are being used.
Over here, Doug.
Hi,
I'm Doug Elliott from Brookings. And, Paul, I thought you had a lot of excellent remarks. Thank you for those. One comment I do have is you expressed perhaps a preference for an accelerated legislative response rather than being so rules-based. I think that's much harder to do when you're not in a parliamentary system. With our separation of powers, it's just a lot harder. But a question for you.
Well, I said either that or change the statutory objectives of the securities regulators so that they at least have a mandate and are held accountable for the stability of those things that fall within their jurisdiction.
I think actually I was hearkening back to earlier remarks you were making about rules-based versus discretion. But a question I have for you, one of the biggest concerns about this single point of entry approach that you're describing is the cross-border aspect, since some jurisdictions aren't designed with the holding companies at the top. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how to deal with that.
So it's a great question, Doug. So first of all, by an accident of history, the McFadden Act that banned interstate banking, nearly all big U.S. banking groups, I defer to Rog, have pure holding companies. Out of a bad law has come a good structure in terms of resolution.
But exception to the usual opposite direction, right?
That is not the case elsewhere in the world. Most of the big banks in Europe and in Asia don't have pure holding companies. I believe they'll need to restructure. I think this, as I say in the paper and I said when I was in office, I think those structural reforms are at least one order of magnitude more significant than Volcker, Vickers, or Liikanen, each of which can be subplots, local subplots. The reason this matters is that what Roger and I are describing can sidestep an awful lot of the cross-border difficulty. Because, say, a subsidiary in Frankfurt of a U.S. bank gets into difficulty, the subsidiary doesn't need to go into resolution or liquidation in Frankfurt. Instead, the intergroup debt can be triggered so that the subsidiary gets recapitalized. There is no default. There is no event of default in the subsidiary that is ailing. Instead, all the losses are pushed to the top of the group, and the group as a whole can be dealt with by one authority. Now, this requires host authorities to then step out of the way and allow the home authority to do that. But one of the things I like about that is for the first time in living memory, this will make home and host authorities have a concrete discussion about cooperation. This isn't to do with goodwill. They will be able to find out in black and white terms whether they are prepared to enter into agreements that will allow this structure to work. And if they don't make those agreements, then they will balkanize. And this will play out over the next year or two. And so a debate that has bedeviled banking supervision for 30 or 40 years, I believe, will come to an end.
I want to thank the panel, and I'm sorry we don't have time for more questions, but this is the kind of conversation we want to continue here.
Very good.
Leave your mics. Christy, you're here. All right, sit there. I don't care. I guess I'm looking at this the wrong way. We're going to go right to the next event so we can stay on schedule. So if you have to step out, that's fine, but can you do it quietly so we can quickly resume the program?
It's turned. I'm pretty sure it's turned off.
So can I ask the people who aren't going to the restrooms or the coffee pot to take a seat so we can move right into the next session and we don't crowd Chairman Bernanke. One of the consequences of the financial crisis has been an enormous increase in the prominence of the Federal Reserve,
And with that, an enormous increase in the criticism of it and the political backlash to a perception that basically the Fed bailed out Wall Street and Main Street got screwed. Now, Ben Bernanke said on 60 Minutes, I didn't set out to save Wall Street. I set out to save Main Street. But in order to save Main Street, I had to save Wall Street, which is logically true and about twice as long as the attention span of the average American. Not in this group, of course. So to think about where the Fed's independence stands and the political risks to it, we asked Don Cohn, who's a colleague of mine here at Brookings, but of course was for a long time at the Federal Reserve, at the end of his career, vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. And then we're going to discuss that with Christy Romer from Berkeley, who was in the Obama administration, the Council of Economic Advisors, and Ken Rogoff at Harvard, who has done a lot of things, but most notably has written a lot about what happens to economies in the wake of financial crises, which turns out to be a really interesting and relevant question. Don.
Thank you, David. So I, as you noted, questions about the attitudes and the attitudes of people towards central bank independence and the role of the Fed in the democratic society, I think, have been raised by the extraordinary actions that the Fed took around and after the crisis, and also by the new regulatory responsibilities it's gotten for systemic risk, as we were discussing in the last panel. So the issue I tried to think about are, what are the risks that Congress will try to make changes in the nature of the arm's-length relationship of the Fed to short-term political pressures? This is a really important question. Logic, history strongly suggest that a less independent central bank is less likely to achieve its objectives, particularly its price stability objective. And I also suspect that a high degree of independence will be necessary for the Federal Reserve or any other central bank to achieve its financial stability objectives. I think I'd like to begin with what I think are useful distinctions about independence. One is the distinction between goals and instruments. I think this is partly due to Stan Fisher, right, Stan, and a paper you wrote with Guy DeBell about differentiating goal independence and instrument independence. I think the general paradigm is that in a democracy, goals are and should be set by the elected representatives of the people, but the instruments should be set by the central bank with considerable independence, with a very substantial arm's-length relationship or arm's-length distance between their decisions on the instruments to achieve these goals, the settings of those instruments, and short-term political pressure on those instruments. Central banks need to be held accountable for outcomes, whether they hit the goals, rather than the inputs, how they're basically achieving them. Now, accountability does include the need to explain as clearly as possible how the instrument settings relate to the achieving goals, but it's ultimately the goals that central banks should be held accountable for. I think a second distinction to make in thinking about independence and the degree of independence of a central bank or other government entity is between monetary policy and regulation. In the case of monetary policy, there's a clear rationale for considerable instrument independence, lags in the policy effects, the tendency for economic cycles to be longer than political cycles. In the United States, those are about 2 years long, the political cycle between elections. Have meant that when instrument settings respond to these shorter-term political pressures, there's too much emphasis on short-term output gains and employment and insufficient attention to the longer-run inflationary consequences of pushing on the output employment side. I think the regulatory accountability nexus is much more complex and difficult on the or the independence accountability nexus, much more complex on the regulatory side. The goal of financial stability is not so easily measured for democratic accountability purposes. We kind of know after the fact when it's not achieved after there's a crisis, but it's hard, unlike inflation and employment, it's hard to measure as you're going through. In the U.S., responsibility for financial stability is split among a number of agencies, requiring cooperation among those agencies. Regulation and supervision clearly affect the distribution of profits and credit, not just the overall levels of output and credit. So there is a potential for fiscal consequences if the financial stability regulation isn't done right, as we saw in the last few years. And these are inherently more political decisions, I think, than the instrument settings for monetary policy. In the U.S., we've had a bifurcated system in which the Federal Reserve had considerable independence for its monetary policy instrument settings, but much less independence in the regulatory side because of its need to cooperate with these other agencies. I must say, with the macroprudential regulation, I think a high degree of instrument independence will be required. Macroprudential regulation will be another form of taking away the punch bowl as the party gets going. And we saw in the lead up to the last crisis, there was considerable political resistance even to the small steps that the regulators were taking to try and make the system safer in the early 2000s. I do think that the threats to monetary policy instrument independence are higher than normal right now. There are a number of reasons for this. As David mentioned and others have talked about, actions around the crisis eroded the public support for the Federal Reserve, and in my paper there's some charts of confidence in the Federal Reserve, a lot and a little, and unfortunately the a lot of confidence has been declining and the little has been rising. There's a perception that the Fed didn't see or didn't try hard enough to address the building vulnerabilities in the crisis. The supplying of liquidity was deemed a bailout. There was little recognition of the sort of classic function of a central bank in a crisis to supply liquidity, to stop runs and fire sales. There was a confusion among the elected representatives between spending and lending. They saw the Fed's lending and they characterized it as spending. And there was this perception, as David mentioned, of helping Wall Street, not Main Street. So the actions of the Federal Reserve in the crisis, in my view, completely justified and necessary and keeping with classic central banking, were not really well appreciated both in the Congress and by the public. And then in the recovery, of course, some actions have been perceived as distorting asset prices, favoring the rich, one hears, penalizing virtuous savers. And the tepid recovery has raised questions about the efficacy and the relative costs and benefits of the unconventional monetary policies that the Fed has followed. So I think there's been a hit to the reputation of the Fed, unfortunate but true. I think the second issue is that the whole discussion of the Federal Reserve and Federal Reserve policy has been caught up in this very polarized political discourse that we're experiencing in this country these days. In the paper, there's a chart of Democrats and Republicans and their support for the Fed, and you can see that polarization shifting and switching and getting worse over time. A very disturbing, in my mind, example of this was the discussion in Republican primaries, presidential primaries, who will fire, quote-unquote, Ben Bernanke fastest. And it was also disturbing to me when the Republican congressional leadership wrote a letter to the Federal Reserve trying to dictate their portfolio choices. This is a direct interference or an attempt to interfere in an instrument setting. And then there were the votes against Ben Bernanke when he was reappointed and Janet Yellen. More recently, the number of votes and the party affiliation. I think you can see the polarization affecting the Fed. The third issue that I think is worrisome is that while many of these objections so far have centered on worries about inflation, perception of an overly accommodative Fed, I think the pressure on independence will only intensify as the Fed exits from its unconventional monetary policies. Tightening is always unpopular with many politicians who want more emphasis on jobs. That's the way independent central banks were created, so they didn't overemphasize that. And this time, after such a long period of high unemployment, I think the tightening issues will be questioned even more. Exit will be complex with many steps, be hard to explain. There'll be plenty of opportunities for second guessing. exit will have fiscal consequences, raising the cost of borrowing for the fiscal authorities and reducing, perhaps eliminating the payments from the Fed to the Treasury at the same time, and that'll also increase the focus in the Congress on this. Fourth, macroprudential policy is mainly the responsibility of the Fed, and to considerable extent, I think this is a terrific addition to the rule book here. It allow monetary policy to concentrate on jobs and inflation, but it could also meet political resistance. It gives the Fed more exposure to pressure, could easily be tightening both policies at the same time. So I think the threats to the potential for threats to independence are substantial here. I do think that worries about these threats should not deter the Federal Reserve from doing what it sees to be the right thing. I think the best defense of instrument independence is success at meeting your objectives. Exiting too soon because you were worried about what people were saying and thereby sending the economy down into recession or preventing it from recovering, or waiting too long because you're worried about the political backlash of your exit will undermine your independence over time because you won't be meeting your objectives. So the best defense of the current degree of independence is doing well, coupled with continued effort to explain what the Fed is doing and why it's doing it. In my paper, I have a very nice quote from Ben Bernanke talking about the importance of transparency to defending independence. Right now, the main immediate threat to Fed independence, or to the degree of Fed independence, seems to be the backing for a general account, a government accountability office audit of monetary policy. This would not be a good idea, in my view. To be clear, this isn't an audit about the accuracy of the financial statements. This is about studying the efficacy of policies. GAO audits everything about the Fed in this regard, all the policies of the Fed, but monetary policy. And this difference was established in the late 70s. Congress, who are opposed to Fed actions, will use the audit to argue at a minimum for delaying perhaps exit from unconventional monetary policies pending a GAO study. Now, the Fed doesn't have to wait for the GAO study. It doesn't have to adhere to the GAO recommendations, but this will be an additional pressure point. It moves the needle in the wrong way. When exit will require preserving independence to contain inflation, it would be a bad signal to financial markets, and it would undermine what I think has been this very useful distinction between independence for monetary policy and independence for regulation policy. So I think it's important to debate this in a democracy, but I certainly hope that there is no action that would significantly undermine or reduce the independence of the Federal Reserve from where it is right now.
Thank you, Don. I should have mentioned in introducing Christy that these academic issues you've or these historical issues you've studied academically for some time. So
all
is
right.
The Fed in as much trouble as Don thinks?
Maybe, but I think maybe for different reasons than Don suggests. So, I think the first thing to say, Don is always so wise and balanced that it is a delight to read anything that he writes. And I have this overwhelming sense that I should just say I agree with him and shut up.
Fortunately, you won't.
But I'm going to do the next best thing, which is to say I agree completely with what he said about the fundamental importance of central bank independence and the threats to the Fed, but maybe for, as I said, a different reason. And I think that somewhat different perspective on why central bank independence matters maybe gives you a different sense of where the threats are coming from. So in his paper, actually, Don gives kind of a classic case for central bank independence, which is politicians have a short-term outlook. They just want to win elections. And so if you let them control monetary policy, they're going to pump up the economy before an election, and that's going to tend to cause inflation. And in contrast, if you delegate monetary policy to an independent central bank, they can take a longer-run view, and then you get less of these problems. You get less inflation. I think the reason I'm skeptical of that story for a couple of reasons. One, the number of people that have tried to look for a political business cycle and evidence that politicians do pump up the economy before elections, by and large, can't find them. I guess with the one exception, and not at all surprising exception, of Richard Nixon, that doesn't seem to be really what politicians do. And if you doubt my skepticism about this usual story, let me just point out the bizarre situation that we find ourselves in today, which in both the United States and Europe, politicians seem to care a lot more about inflation than central bankers do right now, and a lot less about the short-run state of the economy than central bankers seem to. Finally, probably my most compelling reason for not believing that sort of story about politicians and independent central bankers of different time frames really just does come from history. And that is, if you look back over certainly U.S. history, but I'd say in many other countries, when have we made mistakes? When has inflation gotten too high? When have we done other things wrong? By and large, it's not been particularly correlated with central bank independence. It's been correlated with ideas. And when we go wrong is when we have screwy ideas about how the economy operates. So what all this leads me to is the sense that the main reason or rationale for central bank independence is expertise. That by and large, we want to delegate our monetary policy to an independent central bank because we think they'll do better, because monetary policy is really hard, as especially at the zero lower bound, as John Williams' very nice paper from this morning gave us a sense. And just as you wouldn't want to delegate, you wouldn't want Congress telling your physicists how to build your nuclear arsenal, you don't want Congress telling the monetary policymakers how best to achieve price stability and maximum employment. So I think we want monetary policy made by experts because we expect the outcomes to be better. Okay, so if I'm right that the main reason for central bank independence is expertise, because we want a monetary policy made by experts, I think that suggests this is coming back. I think this is actually sort of where Don ended up, that the biggest threat to independence is bad monetary policy decisions, that because then the central bank loses their main argument for independence, that they're better at it than other people. And I one reference in Don's paper to Japan, I found it a little hard to parse. So I couldn't quite tell if he was perhaps lamenting that the democratically elected government had replaced the governor of the Bank of Japan and strong-armed more expansionary monetary policy. I think, in my view, 15 years of deflation had caused the Bank of Japan to lose its right to claim superior expertise. I think an even more compelling example probably comes from the 1930s. In the Great Depression, I think the Federal Reserve thought it was taking actions that were consistent with what was written down in the Federal Reserve Act, and yet their policies were failing miserably. And I think in that situation, it's only natural that central bank independence comes into threat. At some point, accountability has to involve more than just the central bank providing information about why they're doing. At some point, if they're failing dramatically, elected officials should, in fact, take appropriate actions to fix the situation. So if the biggest threat to Fed independence is poor policy, I end up exactly where Don is, which is the biggest counter to that threat is good policy. And so, as Don points out, if the Fed or some other central bank doesn't take actions that it knows to be correct or thinks to be correct because they're afraid of how Congress will react, that's just going to be a disaster. That is, in fact, going to tend to lower their independence rather than strengthen it. Or, as I had exactly the same analogy that Don had, the best defense against the threat to independence is an offense in the form of good policy. Finally, let me just end up and sort of agree with the last point that Don made, which his concern about political partisanship. But again, I think I take it in a little bit of a different direction. I think the thing that worries me most about rising partisanship is kind of the flip side of that, which is a decreasing support or belief in the value of expert opinion. And we see this not just with monetary policy, but with fiscal policy, with climate policy, you name it. I think we're seeing this across the board. And so so I think some of the decline in the support for experts, certainly on monetary policy, can be countered by the Federal Reserve doing an even better job of explaining why they're doing compelling testimony, all of those things. And I think here's where Chairman Bernanke, I think, has made great strides. And I think the greater transparency of the Fed under his watch, I think, will be one of the lasting contributions. But I think the battle needs to be fought much more broadly by the press, by academics, by ordinary voters. And I think it's fabulous we have the Hutchins Center, because I think that's going to be another voice fighting for the importance of expert opinion. Because I think only if we reestablish the value of expertise and evidence-based policymaking can we squelch what I see as sort of the fundamental challenge to Fed independence and actually to good policymaking more generally.
So in an era where everything has to be boiled down to a 140-character tweet, I can't quite count if I could do this right. So the point is independence, but only for intelligent central banks.
fine tweet.
So let me pick up where Christy left off of saying that, in this world where debates become increasingly partisan, and I wouldn't just say expert opinion, but in general the center has been just destroyed and drowned out. It's a pleasure to be here at the founding meeting of the Hutchins Center, which aspires to have nonpartisan analysis. I agreed maybe more broadly with Don's paper than you did, Christy, although I accept the points you made. It's a very understated paper, but he expresses some pretty horrific concerns about what can happen.
We have to work on this guy.
I'm sure with your help, David, get that journalistic push.
If I can blend it in with the Williams paper that we had earlier, sort of very candidly admits, again in an understated way, that economists know less than they thought they did in understanding business cycles, especially today. And I would go to absolutely, we need to look more at history. There's been everything focused on a couple decades, which don't tell us that much. The models, it's not that they don't have financial markets, that they have perfect financial markets, that nothing can ever go wrong, and then you don't have to study them. And, of course, they're the core of the problem. That's going to take us a long time to fix. And then the interplay of this involves the non-linearities. Yes, graduate students are studying this. No, they won't have the answer in the next 5 to 10 years. And so we exist in this world of tremendous uncertainty where we won't know if monetary policy had it right. Ben Bernanke wrote his 1983 paper about the Great Depression. It was, 50 years later, there was a big rethink of what we should have done. And so I certainly come down on the side of having central bank independence as being very important, expertise as being very important. It is an environment where it's very difficult to preserve. Let me just finish on a couple points, understanding the chairman's about to walk in. Certainly, I do think institutions, forecasting, needs to be recalibrated to that. As John pointed out in his paper, we live in a world where we may have cycles more like we had before World War II, more often than we used to, and where we see them around the world. And Carmen Reinhart and I have certainly emphasized this point also. And then that may mirror back into inflation targeting regimes, how you want to design institutions, which were fine-tuned for this more benign environment that we had before the crisis. And let me lastly state there was discussion about monetary policy, fiscal policy, where it could have been inadequate. I think some of that was based on the forecasts not being correct. I have to say my biggest disappointment in the policy response to the financial crisis has not been in either of those. It's really been in structural reforms. where is our third arrow? Where are the reforms that are going to generate, you know, more long-term growth in the United States? Simpson Bowles, I think, had some good ideas about tax reform. Didn't happen. Dodd-Frank has 30,000 pages when you do all the legislation, but I think it's missing higher equity ratios and such. And, of course, having more infrastructure investments, something that all economists seem to agree on all along, but didn't happen nearly the extent we have. So certainly these are problems that need to be studied holistically and present challenges because the Fed gets blamed for everything.
Ken, thank you. Ken, well, that's definitely true. And it's good because if the Fed doesn't get blamed, then the press gets blamed. But so Don says the evidence is central banks have to be independent because otherwise we get a lot of inflation because the politicians are short-sighted. Christie says it's a nice thought, but it's not supported by the evidence. Do you have a side in this?
Well, I mean, I think I tend to think that, I mean, of course, it's better to have expertise than the Federal Reserve made mistakes in the Great Depression because they had almost no expertise. But if you ask any central banker and there are 99 or maybe 999 pressures for lower interest rates compared to higher interest rates, and I think something I'd echo in Don's paper is that, you know, if you think that there were complaints about the policy now, wait till you see when the Fed has to tighten.
Right. Actually, can I disagree with that for a second, which is, I mean, listen to some of the pressure coming out of Congress today. I think I'm sure there will be pressure on that direction when the Fed tries to raise rates, but there's a lot of people in Congress that are saying, that are chomping at the bit for the Fed to tighten, to certainly dial back a lot on extraordinary measures. So I actually think the pressures may be more balanced than you two think.
Although my experience sitting behind chairman for about 30 years was there were many more congressmen arguing for lower rates or not raising rates than were arguing for raising them.
But I think that gets back to this, maybe the world has changed. I think we have to be a little careful not to be fighting the last wars and to know where the pressures
maybe
are today.
Maybe this time is different?
Maybe this time is different.
We have time for a couple questions. Peter Fisher here. It's coming.
Peter Fisher of BlackRock and the BlackRock. A question for all of you, but Don in particular. Is a GAO report really the right place to draw the line? Can any of the four people up there point to an irresponsible GAO report that incited Congress to go off in an irrational direction? Is that really, aren't there more important places to try to draw the line on central bank independence than a GAO audit function?
So I haven't studied GAO reports and agency responses to them. I don't think the GAO report would be a disaster for central bank independence, but I do think it does move the needle a little bit. It would be used by Congress as a tool against the Federal Reserve, and mostly my concern still, I mean, I agree with what Christie said about expertise and things are shifted, will be the concerns will be more intense when they start raising rates. And it's not a big deal. And as I said, the Fed can just ignore the GAO and ignore the call for the report. But I just see it moving in the wrong direction, even if it's not a big deal. That wouldn't, you know, there would be other things that might be proposed that I would see moving it even in worse, even by more. But just seems like the wrong direction at the wrong
Andy?
Time.
So I just wanted to connect this a little bit.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, sorry. I'm Andy Levin from the IMF. To connect it up a little bit to the previous discussion, it seems like between goal independence and instrument independence, there needs to be something maybe we could call strategy and contingency planning. And one way to think about this, which, again, is very consistent with this time is different, sort of, that in normal times, you may have a doctor that you see occasionally, and if you, you know, think he's doing a good job, you keep going to the same doctor, and if not, you switch. That would be kind of a goal. You know, the goal is to be healthy, and the instrument is the doctor kind of figures out, you know, what to do on a regular basis. When you're in unusual circumstances, like your child is sick and may have to have surgery, you want to consult much more closely with the physician, maybe with multiple physicians, and talk through the strategy, which type of surgery, what other sorts of treatments could be appropriate, and be much more involved in those decisions. Now, when it comes to the actual date of the surgery in the operating room, of course the doctor and the other assistants have to be able to use the scalpels and, you know, decide how long the surgery is going to take, and those sort of, so there is a level of instrument independence. But I think these distinctions are what we're seeing today in the political world. And so in that sense, again, maybe this is a direction that Don can expand in consultation with David and thinking how to communicate this to public. Because I think we've been in a situation in the last 5 years that's more like a sick child where the parents are very, very concerned and where there are tough decisions, which surgery and what are the risks and so forth.
So I think I agree. It's very part of the accountability. It's not so clear-cut. And especially in the case of the Federal Reserve, where the Congress has given very vague goals, maximum employment, stable prices, and it's been up to the Federal Reserve, and they've done a good job, particularly in the last few years, defining those goals a little better so they can be held more accountable for them. But the strategy, they've also done more about defining the strategy. So I completely agree that consulting, part of the accountability is consulting on the strategy, explaining how the strategy is supposed to achieve the objectives, what the risks are on either side. And I think under Chairman Bernanke, the Fed's made huge strides in that direction, but will there be challenges for Chair Yellen? You bet, and more to be done. So that communication and consultation is definitely part of preserving independence.
We have time for one more. There's one in the way back there.
Yeah. I'm Luis Jacome from the IMF. I have a question for any of the panelists, and it's related to whether central bank independence is viable in an environment of, let's call it, fiscal dominance. We could cite a number of examples in emerging markets. I don't want to talk about the U.S., what could happen in the future, but the question is it central bank independence viable in an environment of fiscal dominance?
Ken? No. Why don't you define fiscal dominance first?
If the government's desperate enough for money, they'll make the central bank, you know, do what it wants. So, of course, the answer is no. I mean, but this is a matter of degree. Governments can be creative in dealing with their debt problems in lots of ways, short of pressing the central bank into inflation. And they can go through a long menu of options, which, again, Carmen Reinhart and I have written about. But, if it's bad enough, that happens. I don't think we're talking about that in the United States nearly yet.
Thank you. Well, with that, join me in thanking our panelists. And to test your stamina, we're also not going to take a break now, so please stay in your seats if you can possibly do so, and welcome first Glenn Hutchins, then Liaquat Ahamed, and Ben Bernanke.
There we go. Good morning. Have your attention, please. It's my pleasure and privilege to introduce Liaquat Ahmad and Ben Bernanke. At a recent meeting of the American Economics Association, an economist quipped that Mr. Bernanke didn't want the first sentence of his Wikipedia page to be Ben Bernanke. He studied the Great Depression and then caused the next one. So he made sure that was not the case. As we all know, Ben's term as chairman of the Federal Reserve ends in just a couple of weeks. After eight of the most tumultuous years in American economic history, though he started at the end of the Great Moderation, I think the equivalent of setting sail on a calm, sunny afternoon, he soon inherited the wind, a typhoon, really, and had to grapple with the panic of 07, the Great Recession, and an underwhelming recovery. He did this with skill, calm, and creativity, and in my view, quite literally saved us. Despite the massive deleveraging of the last few years, we are still deeply in debt to Ben Bernanke. I thought you economists would like that joke. On a personal note, through my service on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, I have also come to understand how much Ben is admired and regarded with great fondness by his colleagues and staff at the bank. He is truly a remarkable human being. The conversation with Chairman Bernanke will be led by Liaquat, my fellow trustee here at Brookings and my friend. Liaquat is a student of the Great Depression, like the chairman, author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. I recommend everybody go out on Amazon after this and buy it in hardcover. It's a portrait of the central bankers of the 20s and 30s, here and abroad, and particularly highlights the mistakes made by Ben's predecessors, which led in no small measure to the Great Depression. I am sure we have a fascinating discussion ahead of us. As my wife says to our kids, and not quite often to me, time to put on your listening ears.
Don't.
So let me start by thanking the chairman for coming on behalf of Brookings and the Hutchins Center for coming and having this conversation. It's a great privilege. So the way you handle the financial crisis in 2008 will clearly go down as one of your signature achievements. So let me start with that. You've said somewhere that the playbook that you relied on was essentially given by a British economist in the 1860s, Walter Bagehot. And his dictum was that in a financial crisis, the central bank should lend unlimited amounts to solvent institutions against good collateral at a penalty rate. How useful in practice was that rule in guiding you?
It was excellent advice. This was the advice that's been used by central banks going back to the, at least into the 1700s. When you have a market or a financial system that is short of liquidity and there's a lack of confidence, a panic, then the central bank is the lender of last resort. It's the institution that can provide the cash, the liquidity to calm the panic and to make sure that depositors and other short-term lenders are able to get their money. In the context of the crisis of 2008, the main difference was that the financial system that we have today obviously looked very different in its details, if not in its conceptual structure, from what Walter Bagehot saw in the 19th century. And so the challenge for us at the Fed was to adapt Bagehot's advice to the context of a modern financial system. So, for example, instead of having retail depositors lining out, standing in line out the door, as was the case in the 1907 panic, for example, in the United States, we had instead runs by wholesale short-term lenders like repo lenders or commercial paper lenders. And we had to find ways to essentially provide liquidity to stop those runs. So it was a different institutional context, but very much an approach that was entirely consistent, I think, with Badger's recommendations.
Now, you also, rather than lending only to institutions, you intervened in markets. Mm-hmm. Is there a sort of similarly pithy dictum, a Bernanke rule, that you can come up with about when the Fed should intervene in markets and when it shouldn't?
Well, if we're talking about the crisis period, I would say that all the interventions we did fit under the Badgett heading. For example, the commercial paper facility that we set up was essentially designed to prevent a run on this particular form of financing. So it was a different institutional structure, but it was, again, essentially the same Badgett rule being applied in a different institutional context. Now, we have done other interventions, if you will, with our asset purchase program, for example, but that I would call the monetary policy part of our response. So, again, while the analogies between It's a Wonderful Life and people running on the thrift are not always immediately obvious, there was, in fact, a very close parallel throughout the whole response.
Now, the crisis began in August of 2007, mm-hmm. when there was actually a problem with a French money market fund run by a French bank. And if you trace through it, it actually continued until the spring of 2009. So that was a long time. And despite major interventions, you know, after Lehman, despite TARP, you still had a run on Citibank, you still had a run on Bank of America. Why did it take so long to get it under control?
Well, it was not a continuous crisis of equal intensity for that entire period that you described. In the fall of 2007, we were seeing, obviously, a lot of stress in markets. But at that point, it was not obvious whether this was going to be the start of something bigger or whether it was something more comparable, say, to some of the disruptions we'd seen in the 90s, for example, around the Russia debt crisis, for example. There was a critical point that occurred in March of 2008 with the Bear Stearns episode. And that was a period of very intense stress in the repo markets and some other parts of the financial markets. After Bear Stearns, financial conditions calmed fairly notably for a while. Obviously, we remained very alert. We were at beginning to, the Federal Reserve was beginning to supervise the investment banks together with the SEC over the summer. So we were not complacent about the crisis being over, but conditions were certainly more stable after Bear Stearns for a number of months. And there was at least some hope, given that, for example, that the Bush administration was undertaking a fiscal expansionary policy. There was some hope that things might calm. But again, we were very attentive. I think the real intense phase, I think everyone would agree, began with the takeover, the putting into conservatorship of Fannie and Freddie in, I think, early September of 2008. That was followed through this very intense period of Lehman and AIG, the TARP, et cetera. So I think that very intense period from, say, September 1st until the latter part of the year, that was the period of greatest stress and greatest risk. And the combination of our lending programs and the injection of government capital, the fiscal aspect of that, brought the crisis down considerably by the end of the year. Of course, into the next year, we were still working to stabilize the system with our stress testing, addressing some concerns at specific institutions, with our monetary policy and the like. But I don't think it's fair to characterize the crisis as being something that was continuous for a year and a half. Rather, there were periods of ebbs and flows. And the most intense period in September and October, I think we actually got that under control reasonably quickly with the combination of the Fed's liquidity provision, the TARP, the fiscal injections, plus actions by the FDIC and other agencies as well.
Now, Hank Paulson describes having sleepless nights at that time, you know, agonizing that he would go down in history as the Herbert Hoover of this of this episode. I think Tim Geithner once described you as the Buddha of central banks, which implies a certain level of enlightened detachment. Did you have sleepless nights?
Oh, sure, absolutely. But it's my nature, I think, to kind of focus on the problem, you know, and I was so absorbed in what was happening and trying to find response to it that I wasn't really in that kind of reflective mode. I mean, later on, I was kind of like, you know, if you're in a car wreck or something, you're mostly involved in trying to avoid going off the bridge, and then later on you say, oh, my God, you know. during the crisis, as I said, there were some very intense periods. During the September-October 2008 period, not only were we trying to address the crisis, we were trying to deal with our international colleagues around the world. This was a global crisis. And then, of course, we were, you know, constantly testifying or otherwise trying to keep the world informed about what was happening. So it was a very, very intense period. But again, I was, just focused on the task.
Now, your partnership with Secretary Paulson and then Secretary Geithner was clearly central to solving the crisis. Mm-hmm. Now, it's to an outsider, it's remarkable what a united front you presented. But you did have different backgrounds, different personalities. You represented different arms of government. And to some degree, there's a natural tension. The central bank does liquidity. The Treasury does solvency. But the distinction is not very not always very clear. Were there any big disagreements?
So first of all, you're absolutely right that we had a very strong partnership, Paulson, Geithner, and me. We are different people, different backgrounds, and I think we were actually quite complementary in various ways. And we certainly all recognized the seriousness of the situation and the need for cooperation among the Treasury, the Fed, and other agencies. And that was the overwhelming imperative, to work together to try to solve the problem. There were certainly points where, we were trying to address the financial condition of AIG or some other politically very difficult problem, and there was a little bit of discussion about whether or not the Fed or the Treasury should take the lead on that particular area. But in the end, Paulson in particular, who during the heat of the 2008 crisis was the person who was most exposed to the political winds, because as Secretary of the Treasury, he represented the administration and he had to go to Congress and so on. In the end, he always did what had to be done. And I think that was the reason that we worked together. The combination of our complementary backgrounds and skills and the fact that we shared a common purpose. There were many people in the world, economists among them, who thought that it's perfectly safe to let financial companies go down. We heard that even at Jackson Hole a few days before the crisis intensified in September of 2008. The three of us we were all very much in agreement that that was not a wise thing to do, and we were committed to doing that. Let me just also say, though, that while the interventions with large failing firms are the part of the story that gets the most attention, the most controversial, much of the good work that was done was a little bit more under the radar and had to do with our actions to try to stabilize key financial markets like the money market funds, the commercial paper market, the asset-backed securities market, our work to strengthen the commercial banking system and so on, to work with our foreign partners to do currency swaps with 14 other central banks. There's a whole range of things that we did that didn't involve firm interventions, which were less visible but probably occupied a much greater portion of our time and which were at least as important, if not more important, in terms of stabilizing the system.
Now, I think in David Wessel's book, there's a scene where he has you sort of pushing Secretary Paulson to go to Congress. So if the Treasury had gone to Congress to get money earlier, could we have avoided Lehman?
No, for the following reason, which is that even with Lehman, even with the stock market tumbling, as you know, it took two votes of the House of Representatives to get the TARP approved. I remember a senator telling me when we were trying to go around and explain to congressmen why we needed the TARP and why it was critical to the stability of the American economy, and he said, well, I have to tell you, he says, my calls on this from my constituents are 50-50. It's 50% no and 50% hell no. So it was a very unpopular, as you know, very unpopular policy. As Barney Frank has put it, it's one of the most successful government policies ever, and nevertheless, of course, it's also one of the most unpopular. There was no chance. There was no chance that we could have gotten a TARP-type program before it was becoming evident that how bad the situation was going to be. So that was the catch-22 we were in, basically. But it was also clear to me that at that point in mid-September that the ad hoc interventions on which we had relied, given that we didn't really have a framework for resolving these firms, had reached their limit. And we had no choice but to involve Congress, and I was very clear about that.
So let me talk a little bit about that political backlash. I mean, I get the impression that Dodd-Frank, for example, while giving the Fed more power to prevent a crisis, limits the ability of the Fed to intervene in the way that it did in 2008. Can you tell us more about that? Are you worried about what the consequences of that are?
No, we were supportive of those changes, and we're totally comfortable. What we're talking about here is the so-called 13-3 provisions, which allow the Fed to make emergency loans to individuals, partnerships, and corporations under certain conditions, unusual and exigent circumstances, as it was called. And we used those tools for the first time, essentially since the Great Depression, to support the collective effort of the government to prevent the collapse of some critical firms, as well as doing broad-based lending in a number of different key markets, as I was describing before. The former, the interventions for firms, again, happened because there was no framework. There was nothing but the standard bankruptcy code. And the trouble with the bankruptcy code in this context is that what bankruptcy does is, first and foremost, is defend the interests of the creditors, which is a great thing, but there's no recognition in the bankruptcy code that you also have to worry about the stability of the financial system. So in any case, we didn't have anything like that in 2008. So the Dodd-Frank Act, Title II, created an orderly liquidation authority, which provided much more structured and flexible approach to addressing a failing critical firm in the middle of a crisis. So we don't need that authority anymore. We have tools now, which we didn't have, to address individual firms. At the same time, the 13-3 rules in Dodd-Frank do permit, and we just wrote the implementing regulation for this, they do permit a so-called broad-based program so that our actions with regard to the commercial paper, asset-backed securities, and some of the other markets that we provided liquidity to presumably would still be legitimate, still be legal, as would the primary dealer facility, which was open to all primary dealers. So the key things that we did would still be possible, although we have to get the Treasury Secretary's permission now. And we're perfectly happy that there are alternative ways to deal with a failing firm, and that the Fed doesn't have to intervene in that way we did in 2008.
Now, we all heard from Don Kern this morning talking about the whole political environment. I mean, are you worried about the political backlash against the Fed, the consequences both for monetary policy and how future Fed decision makers will be able to respond in a crisis?
Well, so first of all, it wasn't really a surprise. This is another place where history helps you. If you think about the 1930s, we had exactly, as you well know, we had exactly the same kind of reaction. In fact, it was much more intense.
Although those guys did the wrong thing and you did the right thing.
Well, it wasn't so much the Fed. It was because the Fed did keep its head down in the 30s, unfortunately. But the government in general, you know, there were marches on Washington and strong populist movements and serious talk about revolution, even in, you know, among some parts of the population. And of course, so Roosevelt, what he argued was that the strong actions he was taking were about saving capitalism, essentially. And of course, analogously to the report that we had on the crisis in Congress this time, there was the PCORA Commission, and all of that has happened before. And it's not surprising, in a sense, that you would get this populist type of reaction. I guess the only thing, one comment I would make is that the alternative of not doing what the Fed was created to address financial panics, and its independence and its ability to act quickly is a key feature of what the Fed is about. And if we had not done that, and if the financial system had imploded and the economy had plunged into even a deeper depression, I think the populist reaction would have been pretty bad as well. So we were kind of stuck one way or the other. So we did the right thing, I hope. We tried to do the right thing. There certainly has been pushback. We hope that as the economy improves and as we tell our story and as more information comes out about why we did what we did and so on, that you know that people will appreciate and understand that what we did was necessary, that it was in the interest of the broader public. It was a Main Street set of actions aimed at helping the average American. And as time passes and that becomes clearer, I'm hopeful that these political concerns will wane. That being said, the reason the Fed is independent is so that it can take emergency actions or any other actions, policy actions, independent of short-run political pressures. And the day that we allow those short-run political pressures to make us do something which is not the right thing for the economy, then our independence at that point is effectively gone.
So I could keep on going about the financial crisis, but let's move to monetary policy. I mean, in many ways, you had a playbook for how to deal with the financial crisis. The monetary policy post the financial crisis and reviving the economy, I mean, we heard from John Williams this morning that, you know, essentially this was, you know, there was a little bit of theory, some of which you had helped develop, but we were really operating blind. So in devising QE and all these other unconventional monetary policies, were you pretty confident that the theory would work? Or that whatever you, that going into it?
Well, the problem with QE is it works in practice, but it doesn't work in theory. That's
yeah, that's right. And the other way about forward guidance, probably.
Right. Well, so I think it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that this was all de novo, that it was all unprecedented. Obviously, we had the case of Japan, and they had taken some of these actions. We had those experiences. We learned some things from the 30s and so on. I think of QE as being a basic monetarist principle, which is that these are some of the ideas that Friedman and Schwartz and Friedman talked about, which is that the way you can stimulate the economy is by swapping liquid assets for less liquid assets. That's essentially what an open market operation is. On the side of forward guidance, et cetera, people like Michael Woodford and Paul Krugman and others had talked about those issues and how that would work. So we were relying on research. I think, just let me say parenthetically, I think that monetary policy in general is an extraordinary example of how thinking within a policy institution and in the academic world can, you know, mutually benefit each other. And we made use of the ideas that we got from academia and also ideas that came from our own experiments. The basic problem was that interest rates, the short-term interest rate was effectively zero as of December 2008, that any analysis would suggest that there was not enough economic monetary support to achieve a sufficiently robust recovery. We needed additional stimulus, and these were the two methods with some experimentation that we came to. But again, I do think, by the way, I do think that they both have been helpful, and we've learned a lot. But I would disagree that these are, you know, completely novel ideas. A number of different central banks have tried various forms of forward guidance, and the Federal Reserve talked even before the crisis about considerable period and those kinds of things as well. So what we were doing was trying to build on what others had already done.
Now, QE was much more controversial than sort of the lender of last resort type of things that you did. And you had to deal with a fair number of skeptics, including within the FOMC. How did you persuade so many people to go along with it?
I'm not sure I would agree with you on that. Which one was more controversial? I think they both had elements of controversy. Well, we were looking for additional measures that we could take, again, to provide additional accommodation and to help stabilize financial markets. You know, the biggest measures, you know, some of the biggest measures we took were in late 2008 and then in March of 2009 when we put in a very big program. And that program, the beginning of it, was very broadly supported in the FOMC. It was felt that that intervention would both provide very much needed monetary policy support, and in addition, it would add to the liquidity of markets in general, which were still under great stress at that time. And so the beginning of it was certainly a broadly supported idea. Subsequent to that, you know, that gave us the opportunity to see what the effects were and to do analysis and so on. And the staff analysis and a pretty large literature that is out there. I think John's bibliography had some of that in there, has suggested that while there are differences in views about how effective QE is, the great majority of studies have found that there, it is at least somewhat effective, and that given that we were, you know, at the limits of what conventional monetary policy could do, we felt that we needed to take additional steps, and for the most part, it has been supported. A number of the folks who have, you know, who have voted against it or have been critical of it, have in some cases have argued that perhaps it wasn't needed or something like that. I don't think that a large number of people on the committee feel that it's inherently not effective.
So. I mean, we know what the benefits are, because they're lower long-term rates, lower mortgage rates. So what are the costs that you most worry about?
Well, I think that some of the costs that people talk about are not really costs, and I'll mention a couple. One cost that gets talked about is, oh, this is going to be inflationary. And while, of course, it's always possible for the Fed to raise rates too late or too early and so on, I think we have plenty of tools now at this point. We've developed all the tools we need to manage interest rates, to tighten monetary policy, even if the balance sheet stays where it is or gets bigger. And because we can do that, that means that we can run monetary policy in the normal way and avoid any risks of undue inflation or other such problems. So I don't think that's a concern. And those who've been saying, you know, for the last 5 years that we're just on the brink of hyperinflation. I mean, I think I would just point them to this morning's CPI number and suggest that inflation is just not really a significant risk of this policy. Another concern that people have talked about is the idea that the Fed might take capital losses, which is not, of course, not impossible, but I would say that from a social point of view, we have already not only helped the economy, but we've actually helped the fiscal situation quite significantly with hundreds of billions of dollars that we've remitted to the Treasury. And that doesn't even take into account the benefits for the public fisc of a stronger economy, more tax revenues and the like. So that risk is, again, not a true social economic risk. It's, if anything, perhaps a public relations risk for the Fed, but it's not a serious economic risk. The main risk that that my colleagues have pointed to is various aspects of financial stability or potential for financial instability. There is always some concern that for any kind of easy monetary policy, that after a period of time there may be some reaching for yield or some misvaluation of assets. And given what happened, of course, just 5 years ago, we're extraordinarily sensitive to that risk. Now, of course, that's really for different kinds of monetary policy. QE, in addition, works on term premiums to a significant extent, and we simply have less knowledge, information about how term premiums are determined, and therefore there's a little bit additional concern, volatility associated with the management of QE. So there's certainly some risks there. Our strategy, though, has been not to distort monetary policy in order to address those risks directly. Indeed, insufficient monetary policy accommodation, if it leads to a weaker economy and bad credit outcomes, et cetera, is also a financial stability risk. So our basic approach has been, at least for the first, second, and third lines of defense, to rely on supervision, regulation, monitoring, macroprudential policies, and all that whole set of tools that we have and are developing to try to avoid potential problems. We also look very carefully at the implications of any potential kind of financial imbalance. For example, is that asset class heavily levered? Is it supported heavily by leverage, which would in turn mean that a sharp drop in that valuation would lead to other types of problems? Those are the kinds of things we look at, and we've greatly increased our ability to monitor and analyze those types of situations. So our goal is to address financial instability concerns primarily, at least in the first instance, through supervision, regulation, and other microeconomic types of tools. But it is something that I think of the various costs that have been ascribed to QE, I think it's the only one that I find personally credible, frankly. And it's the one that we have spent the most time thinking about and trying to make sure that we can address it best we can.
Sort of bottom line, for the moment, you're not worried about too much froth in financial markets.
Well, it's always, of course, bad luck to make any forecast about any particular market. But the markets currently seem to be broadly within, the metrics of market valuation seem to be broadly within historical ranges. The financial system is strong. The key financial institutions are well capitalized. So we're watching this very, very vigilantly. We've developed tremendous additional capacity for doing that. But at this point, we don't think that, and I think I can speak for my colleagues in this, we don't think that financial stability concerns should, at this point, detract from the need for monetary policy accommodation, which we are continuing to provide.
So last question, then we'll turn it over to the audience. Has the crisis done long-lasting damage to the economy? And if so, what are the channels that you really worry about?
Well, that's an excellent question. I don't think we'll know the answer for a while. I would note first, I think it's important to say that there's been a benefit, which is that obviously we've done a root and branch reformation of the financial regulatory system and of financial markets, which will provide greater stability, I hope, and more effective credit provision in the future. So there is at least that benefit, although, of course, it was a very expensive gain. There are some ways in which the crisis could have effects on the, if you will, the supply side of the economy, which means it might have a longer-term implication. One, of course, is the effect of long-term unemployment on labor supply. Obviously, there's been declines in labor force participation, part of which is certainly due to ongoing trends that were in place before the crisis, but some of which might be due to the depth of the recession itself, and that could affect the available labor supply going forward, and of course has very important direct effects on those who are unemployed and their families, and so that's certainly a concern. And it is, by the way, a motivation for being aggressive with monetary policy to try to prevent those kinds of effects from taking hold. Another kind of perhaps more longer-lasting effect has to do with productivity gains. We've seen very slow increase in productivity recently. We don't fully understand why. Some of it may just be low demand, for example. But it could be that the financial crisis has led to slower pace of innovation, slower pace of firm formation, less capital investment, which has led, in turn, to a less rapid pace of innovation. There's interesting work. There's an economic historian named Alexander Field who's written that the 1930s was actually a period of great innovation, but it didn't show up in the productivity statistics because with the economy in depression, there weren't markets sufficient to make those innovations commercial. So something similar may have happened to some extent here. Now, all that being said, you know, these are important effects, but none of them are permanent, truly permanent. I mean, they eventually the economy will return to the growth path that it was on prior to the crisis or something close to that. So these are long-lasting and very serious potential effects, but I don't think that they are truly permanent.
Great. So we're going to turn to some questions, which David's
going to... We have a couple minutes for questions. I want to ask if there's any of the people who are on the panel this morning want to pose a question. If not, we'll go to the audience. Okay. Rob, you want to stand up and wait for a mic and tell us who you are? And let's try and keep the questions to questions. And 140-word character is a good...
Ned Lamont. Mr. Chairman, as a student of history, talk about the role of the president. During the Great Depression, we had Franklin Roosevelt, fireside chats, explainer-in-chief, making some sense and comfort out of the chaos. Did we have that in 2008? Because my sense is the American people, Main Street, Wall Street, there's still a great deal of confusion, and I think we're paying the consequences of it even today.
Well, it was a big challenge to explain what was going on, at the Federal Reserve, we tried to do it. We didn't always succeed, I'm sure. President Bush, I give President Bush actually a lot of credit. He gave a lot of leeway to me and to Secretary Paulson to do what we thought was right. He supported us throughout the process. I remember him going on television and giving a speech about the TARP, which must have been very difficult for him, you know, given his political predilections and the cost of that from the political side. So it was difficult. It was difficult. Communication was a challenge throughout this whole process, but I wouldn't put it on the president or anyone else. I mean, I think all of us who were involved in the policymaking had a role and had a responsibility to explain as best we could. And this was a time at which, you know, when I came to the Fed, I was very interested in increasing the transparency of the Fed, although my motivations were primarily for making monetary policy more predictable and more accountable. But as it turned out, transparency was very helpful on other dimensions as well. And in particular, I tried where I could to bring the story not just to markets and to other economists, but to a more mainstream type of audience, you know, on television or on town halls and things of that sort. But it was very challenging, frankly, to do that. We had obviously had other things to do as well. If you look around the world, there are populist reactions, you know, in most countries where there were serious financial crises. That's probably not avoidable completely. And what we have to do is, again, to explain what we did, why we did it, and try to win back the confidence of the public. And that's, I think, an important objective for all of us around the world.
Gentleman here in the blue shirt, Carrie.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a question that broadens from Mr. Lamont's question. And that is, you've been in a remarkable place during a remarkable period of time. You are a great student of history. And what I'm interested in knowing is whether this experience has caused you to think in different terms about the strengths and weaknesses of our political system, and in particular, how you think the system, and I mean that writ large, the executive branch, the Congress, the people themselves, whether it gave you a different perspective, a stronger perspective, a more questionable perspective on how well American governance is working at this point in the 21st century.
So yes or no question?
Yes or no. there's two separate questions there. One has to do with sort of the structure of the American government as given to us by the Constitution and all of the evolution of the government since then. And then there's the question of our current political situation in terms of the mix of views and ideologies which are currently on the Hill in particular. In terms of the former, without making a judgment at all, and I'm certainly not qualified to make a judgment about overall political systems, one thing that really struck me during the crisis was that the governments that had more parliamentary-type systems were better able to respond quickly to a financial crisis. I think, you know, it was envisioned in the Constitution that the president might have to act quickly to respond to a military or some kind of foreign relations crisis, and that's why the president has a lot of flexibility to take action in the event of a military attack, for example. Of course, ultimately going to Congress to get ratification. During the crisis, say the British, for example, very quickly put together a plan to address their banking problems because in this particular case they had a government which controlled the legislature and was able to respond quickly. So I think that turned out to be a problem during the crisis. Now, obviously, some of the legislative actions that have been taken in Dodd-Frank and so on have tried to set up frameworks whereby the Fed, the Treasury, and other regulators would be able to take necessary actions, like, for example, the liquidation authority. So there has been an attempt to address that structural problem with respect to financial crises. On the broader question of governance, I have felt some frustration. Certainly, it's been a concern that we've had these periods of fights over the debt limit and things of that sort. I think those things have caused problems for the economy. They've hit confidence. They certainly have prevented more positive, constructive action on the part of the government to address some of these concerns in terms of unemployment, for example.
you know, again, that's not a feature of the nature of our government. It's just a current. It's just the current situation in terms of the disagreement and range of views that are currently on the Hill.
Another question, Krishna.
Krishna Guha, ISI. Mr. Chairman, when we look beyond legacy of the crisis itself in terms of deleveraging and the other effects that Ken Rogoff and others have written about so much, there are other factors that at play, the aging of the population here in the U.S. and in much of the industrialized world, the increasingly fractal distribution of income gains, as well as international factors such as the continuation of the global savings glut, reserve accumulation by emerging market economies. When you look over the longer sweep ahead and beyond when we may have finally achieved full employment again here, do you expect that we will be in an era of sustained low interest rates?
I wasn't expecting that little end there to that, that question. I'm hopeful that we won't be in a situation. I mean, part of the implication of your question is the zero lower bound. Is that going to be relevant a lot or not? It's hard to know. Certainly, there are a couple of ways of avoiding the zero lower bound. One would be to avoid deep recessions like the one that we've just we are now emerging from. Another would be to use a more balanced mix of monetary and fiscal policy in when responding to recession so as not to over-rely on low interest rate monetary policies. Given inflation, the determinant of long-run interest rates is going to be the rate of return to capital investment, productivity, and so on, and that's a huge debate, as you know. The jury is still out about longer-term technological trends and the productivity of capital. One of the other things you mentioned, I think, has been part of the concern, which is the global savings glut. During the period before the crisis, the U.S. had a 6% trade deficit, and we still have a trade deficit, which means, of course, that 6% of our domestic aggregate demand is being, drained off essentially abroad. At the same time, among the richest countries in the world, are receiving large amounts of capital inflows on net, which both of those things are going to tend to push down interest rates. So one way to address low interest rate problems would be to get better balance in growth in terms of trade and capital flows. Another way, again, is to have a better balance of monetary and fiscal policy, including good investments in productivity-enhancing projects like effective infrastructure, for example. But in the end, it's going to depend a lot on the return to innovation, return to new capital. As I said, I think that question is still very much open, but I'm not yet ready to conclude that very low interest rates are going to be a permanent condition.
I think that today has been a fantastic start for the Hutchins Center. I think we have at least as many questions to pursue at noon as we did at 9 o'clock, which means that we have a great opportunity. I want to thank not only the participants who were both very helpful in helping frame the event, but mainly kept to the schedule, which, as you know, is always a challenge. And also, I don't have the long list of names of people who made this possible, who make an event like this successful, but anonymously, I want to ask you to join me in thanking not only them, but Ben Bernanke and Liaquat Ahmed.